Development to order and welcome. I was going to say we were going to open as a subcommittee, but we are now opening as a full committee. And I appreciate those who were unable to testify, who had been on the schedule on Thursday, rejoining us today to do this. For those who were not here on Thursday, I want to just go over a couple of basic points of what we're trying to achieve here. So you'll have an understanding of the parameter, particularly those who may have signed up for the public testimony part of today's hearing later this afternoon. And that is, and the committee is trying to get a grasp on what, if any, legislative role we should play in the acquisition, sale, disposition of utilities, particularly electric utilities. It is inevitable that we are going to use the current example in much of the dialogue and those who have been invited as a kind of a test ground to evaluate some of these principles, but in no way is it our purpose, or in fact can we have any effect, or should we, on the current deliberations before the PUC, as they have the entire record and have gone through many hours of that, and we trust that they will do so in rendering a judgment based on the current law. What we want to know is, in the result of changes in how that case might be disposed or future cases, whether we have the proper structure and if there's other oversights or changes that we should make to ensure the public interest as defined by the statute. With that, our invited testimony is going to continue, and I'm going to ask that Peggy Fowler and Jim, is it Pyro? And Barbara Hale, please come forward from Portland General Electric. Welcome, and I appreciate you taking the time to come a second time.
Thank you, and we'll be brief, but we're just saying maybe we'll be so brief I just come up by myself. But Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Fowler. I'm CEO and President of Portland General Electric. Have with me Barb Halley, who's our Assistant General Counsel, and Jim Pyro, our CFO, for questions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify here today and to set the record straight about certain misunderstandings regarding PGE. The last few years have been filled with Enron news, and it's been hard for some to get an accurate picture of our company. First and foremost, PGE's operations are strong and our employees are doing well. Second, the regulatory system established by the Oregon Legislature and administered by the Oregon Public Utility Commission works well to protect customers. Our mission as a company is very clear. PGE is a company customers depend on to provide electric service in a safe and reliable manner with excellent customer service at a reasonable price. Dedicated PGE employees have been the key to the company's success for over 115 years. I'm especially proud of their strength and resiliency during recent years, which have been challenging to both our company and the utility industry in general. My coworkers are on the front lines each and every day. The business and regulatory model established by the Oregon Legislature and overseen by the OPUC has allowed PGE to remain financially healthy while adequately protecting customers. This model combines the financial discipline and management practices of a private business with the government oversight necessary to protect customers. 3 out of 4 U.S. electric customers are served by investor-owned utilities with government oversight. The best evidence that the OPUC process works is that throughout Enron's collapse, the ring fence provisions and other protections provided by the OPUC kept PGE strong and prevented a number of possible negative outcomes, including a sell-off of generating plants or a split-up of the company itself. In the TPG transaction, the Commission is considering even more conditions than were approved in the Enron merger. The OPUC has been provided with the information necessary for it to apply the law and make a decision. Other areas that the OPUC regulations oversee are operations, power supply, safety, customer service, and virtually everything in between. It's probably no surprise to hear that we don't always agree with the outcomes of the OPUC process. In just the last couple of years, we have had significant disagreements regarding fundamental operating costs that the OPUC has not allowed us to recover, such as making up for poor hydro conditions. This can impact PGE's rate of return, which, by the way, is not a guaranteed rate of return, but an allowed rate of return, which is an important distinction. While we sometimes disagree with the OPUC, there's a lot we agree with, too. Most recently, the Commission acknowledged our integrated resource plan, under which we're acquiring 200 megawatts of new wind power and building a new 400-megawatt power plant in Clatskanie, Oregon. Overall, it benefits everyone to have an open, public, regulatory process for Oregon's investor-owned utilities, where customer groups, the OPUC staff, utilities, and other interests are at the table on a regular basis. But it doesn't end at simply having a good regulatory model. As a utility, it is critical that we manage our business by focusing on operational excellence and efficiency. Let me give you just a few quick examples. Our system performance, measured by industry standards for average interruption duration and for average interruption frequency, continues to be the best in the state. PGE's executive team is smaller by one-third compared to June 2002. Staffing levels of full and part-time employees have been reduced by 70 positions over the past 2 years. Our customers continue to give PGE high marks in overall satisfaction. In our most recent residential customer satisfaction survey, PGE was in the first quartile of 86 utilities that were evaluated across the nation. This is a backdrop against which I would like to bring up the recent mentions of the diligence report that was released about PGE. We respectfully disagree with the conclusions in the due diligence report. The due diligence report was done in isolation without the thorough input of PGE. We look forward to working with TPG and the new board, if this transaction is approved, to identify possible efficiencies and improvements. At PGE, we have a disciplined process for continually defining goals, measuring our performance, and making and implementing improvement plans. It is always a balancing act with cost efficiencies on one side and reliability and good service on the other. While proud of our strong accomplishments, we always strive to do even better. One of the areas on which we continue to focus our attention is managing our price impact on customers. Power costs are the single largest component of our rates, which is why power supply resource planning is so important. Power costs have risen dramatically in recent years. This is not just a PGE phenomenon. You're seeing it in natural gas costs at the gasoline pump and elsewhere. For example, the cost of power in 1996 averaged about $17 a megawatt hour, compared to about $50 a megawatt hour today. Nevertheless, despite the constant upward pressure on power costs, adjusted for inflation, our rates are below where they were 20 years ago. In fact, our rates are lower than the national average and comparable to many similar public utilities in Oregon and Washington, including Seattle City Light, Clark County People's Utility District, and Snohomish PUD. I want to share one last example of how PGE and its employees are doing. We're pleased that at the beginning of this month, the 401k accounts of PGE employees are no longer being administered by Enron. PGE's pension plan has always been managed by PGE and remains healthy and intact. The financial harm to employees that you probably have heard about was a result of a loss of value in our Enron stock in our 401k plans. Despite the loss of the value in the 401k plans and other difficult circumstances resulting from Enron's ownership, PGE employees' on-the-job dedication, levels of charitable giving, and volunteerism in their communities have never faltered. The bottom line about my coworkers and me is that we want to move on with our lives, get back to being recognized as a company that is headquartered here, and be seen as a leader in our region's business community. We've had an opportunity to work with TPG and its representatives over the past year. If the transaction is approved, we look forward to working with them and the new board. In closing, PGE remains a strong and viable company. Our employees are doing well, and the regulatory process that the legislature created and the OPUC administers works well for our customers and for Oregon. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fowler. I'm going to have a couple to start off with, and then, as I did before, we'll defer to members of the committee. I'd like to ask about two issues that developed in our Thursday hearing, which you're familiar with. that I mentioned at the end of the hearing started to look at areas that perhaps the legislature should be involved in, specifically the collecting of taxes by the utility and in the rate process, and how those taxes do or do not make their way to the end recipient. And secondly, the issue of the public interest, which under UM 1011, for the first time now, the PUC is trying to define further with the net benefits analysis versus the harm. And I'm going to put those two together and look and ask for your expertise, I think, as a utility chief executive, understanding your position, and we certainly heard from the Enron folks who have been asked to dispose of the asset and made it very clear they want to get the stock out of there, and realizing your responsibility to them, and I understand that. But I want to review just the history of this, and then as we look forward to how, as a legislative body, we can empower the PUC not to let this happen again. And you're well aware of these numbers. From 97 to 2003, PGE collected, according to the numbers, well over $700 million in taxes of all times from ratepayers' pockets. But during that same period of time, less than a million of that $700 million actually went to the entities, primarily the federal government and the state. Specifically for the state of Oregon, although the rate allowed you to collect through 97 and 2001 $14 million from ratepayers for state taxes, and $12 plus million dollars per year from 2001 through 2004, in the year 97, and I just want to talk about Oregon now for a bit, none of that money went to the state treasury. In 98, $0 collected by the state treasury. In 99, $0 collected by the state treasury. In the year 2000, $0 collected by the state treasury. And maybe you could answer this one. PG actually got, through Enron, actually got a $34,000 rebate of taxes that were never paid. I assume you can answer this if this is an amended return from a previous year or an extended tax credit, but actually got $34,000 more and didn't pay anything, and paid $10.90 in 2002 and $10 in 2003. So, if you're looking at you collecting from ratepayers these dollars and they don't end up, because the PUC has a policy, and one can argue this is a good policy, that you're allowed to recapture those in rates as a standalone entity, but knowing that they will be transparently manipulated in a situation that we had with an out-of-state owner who has unregulated activity. And then you look at the transfer of utilities, and the PUC weighs a net benefit, which has in the agreements so far and in the offer, I think, from TPG this time, there's a number of issues there, but primarily that's been defined as rate breaks, rate credits for ratepayers. But if I'm an Oregon taxpayer and I have on one pocket been allowed from your tax collecting authority given you by the PUC, taking $80 or $90 million out of my one pocket and say my net benefit is giving you back $50 million of that over a 5-year period as a credit, somehow I don't see that as a net benefit. That looks like a net fleecing of the ratepayer who is still $40 million short. And as we look forward to these types of acquisitions, what do you see as a viable option, and do you think that is justifiable, and do you believe that that is a net benefit for the ratepayer when he's being paid, he or she are being paid those credits with their own dollars and not even all those dollars?
Let me make a couple of comments, and then I'll let Jim Pyra, our CFO, address this a little bit. I think Chairman Beyer did about as good a job explaining this as I possibly could, and that it is a very complicated question. It's not just an issue for Oregon. It's not just an issue for PGE. It's an issue for Scottish Power and Northwest Natural Gas and Quest and everybody else that's out there that may need to be looked at and be dealt with. But it is done the way it's done here in Oregon is the way it is done in most states. And the issue get into in truing up something like this is there are years perhaps when there is money that isn't paid, and then there are years when there is more money that needs to be paid, and are you going to take from customers to do that just like you would give back to customers to do that? And that's where it gets kind of complicated and complex, I believe. And maybe Jim wants to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it really gets to this issue of consolidated tax returns. We try to follow the law. We do follow the law. We try. We do follow the law in terms of...
Mr. Chair, please state his name.
Oh, yes, please state your name.
This is Jim Pyro. I'm the CFO. We follow the law in terms of filing a consolidated tax return. That's consistent with the Internal Revenue Code, and we've done that since we've been part of Enron. There was a period during 2001 and 2002 we were deconsolidated where we filed our own tax return. So we do that according to the law, and then we follow the regulatory policy in terms of determining our taxes on a standalone basis. And that's the way it's been done in Oregon since I've been around. It's been the history of the policy of the commission. It's the way as many states are doing that. And the primary reason for that is you don't want to reflect the cost of non-utility operations in the utility cost structure. And that's why they've gone that way. If we had a non-utility operations and it was causing us to pay higher taxes, you wouldn't want to go to the customers and say, we want the customers to pay higher taxes because the company is more taxable. So it kind of goes both ways, and that's why they came up with that policy, was to try to isolate the utility operations so customers are not impacted by anything going on in the other area of the organization. And the other thing I'd like to mention is the reason your taxes are lower is you incurred losses. You incurred some expenses that weren't covered. The customers are not paying for those expenses on the non-utility operations, and therefore they wouldn't get the deduction for those expenses. So the policy was designed to insulate the customers from any impact of non-utility operations. And it's been that way as far as I can recall. So,
Mr. Pyro, I just want to follow up on that.
Yep.
That has been the policy for setting rates because of that very reason, is to insulate ratepayers from those unregulated losses that could be held by a company. But if at the same time you reverse that analysis when you file the consolidated tax return, then all of a sudden you have jumped off the level in terms of having that same policy, because now you do have unregulated income or losses that are used to offset. Mm-hmm. And I would think that And clearly, our understanding is, as we look forward to what types of legislation we might want to consider, is that the Public Utility Commission could be given the authority to say that, indeed, this is the proper policy to protect our ratepayers in setting the rates for the collection of taxes, but also a requirement that they file in that same way in order to make sure that that revenue stream is, in fact, consistent with regulated and unregulated revenues. What do you see as the problem with that?
Well, again, the problem with that is if you had a non-utility operations that was highly profitable and caused the corporation to pay higher taxes under that policy, then you'd go to the customers and have to ask them to pay those higher taxes for something that's unrelated to serving electric service. For example, if we had a very good hydro year, for example, here's our prime example, very good hydro year, and so our costs go down because we have essentially we have extra hydro that we can sell into the marketplace or serve our customer loads. We're more profitable. As a result of being more profitable, we would pay more income taxes. It seems contrary to good policy to say because we're more profitable, we have to go to our customers and ask them for more income taxes that we would have to pay if we were just a standalone utility, ignoring the consolidation issue. So you get some adverse outcomes that would be disadvantaged to customers. And on the flip side, if we had a poor hydro year like we did last year, where we lost $22 million because of the poor hydro conditions, we'd have less taxes to pay. It means we incurred higher expenses, and yet we'd have to be giving customers a tax break because we had less cost, but yet we didn't earn our allowed rate of return. So you get these kind of bad outcomes if you try to follow the exact taxes that the utility pays. And so that's why we've tried to do it, and that's why I think the policy was developed that way, is try to isolate those things and really focus on just the cost of providing utility operations.
But you can't even those out, especially if you do some type of a true-up program to make sure those are balanced. And I always like to defer to my committee, so rather than dominate that, I'm going to open up at this point to committee members to follow up. So questions for Ms. Fowler. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to state for the record that the LC-819 draft that I spoke about last week about this very issue, collecting taxes that aren't owed, has been dropped as a bill today, and that is now Senate Bill 408, for those of you who want to start tracking that. I have a couple of questions for Ms. Fowler. Ms. Fowler, can you give us an example of an instance in which a financial speculator, such as Texas Pacific, has bought a utility and produced results that were positive for customers? And I don't want you to cite Warren Buffett, because he never sells anything. And Texas Pacific has made it clear they're going to sell. So can you cite me an example? Yeah, on the utility side. I don't know if I really can, that I'm familiar with. I mean, Mid-America with Warren Buffett would be the one that came to mind, but you're right, he hasn't sold that.
He's a smart man. He doesn't sell much.
Several others have tried, but they haven't been able to be completed yet.
All right. Thank you. And if you something comes to your mind after you leave the committee, I'd appreciate some follow-up. Mr. Chair, can I ask another question?
Yes.
Thank you. The Arizona Public Utility Commission recently rejected the sale of Tucson Electric Power to Colbert, Kravis, and Roberts, who's had a checkered past in our own state. That proposed transaction was similar to TPG's bid for PGE, except that Arizona has a lower standard for acceptance. They have a no harm standard. Oregon has a public benefits or a net benefit public benefit standard. And also, they are not bankrupt. Their parent company is not bankrupt. So what lesson for Oregon is there in that rejection in Arizona?
I think probably the best lesson for Oregon is to let the Public Utility Commission do its job and review the transaction and look at it from the legal standard and make their decision. That's essentially what happened there.
Okay, well, all right, that's an answer, and I'm going to accept it. Mr. Chair, I have two short ones.
Okay, proceed.
Texas Pacific said there is no inconsistency. Now, this is an interesting one. I'm going to ask you to track it. But they said there's no inconsistency between their public statements and the information contained in the so-called Tahoe documents. And the Oregonian quoted you as saying you strongly disagree with the conclusions, and you say that in your written and oral testimony today. So here's the tricky part. If you disagree with the documents, and they say, Texas Pacific says, those documents are consistent with their public statements, does that mean you disagree with their public statements? Do you follow that?
I think I follow that. And Texas Pacific might be better off to address this, but I don't believe they are inconsistent with their public statement because the documents that were used were for due diligence to make ranges and estimates of what possibly might occur. And then they were done very early in the process, and the more they have learned about PGE, they have modified some of their decisions and some of their approach to things, which I think is more consistent with their current comments about things. And plus, anybody who was involved in the case had access to those documents, and as I understand, there was a fair amount of discussion around pieces of that. So if that isn't a plan to operate the company, it's a plan to analyze and look at it from a financial standpoint.
And so, Mr. Chair, Ms. Fowler, when you say that, then when you read the analysis that they made, that they called you an 80s-style managed company, mismanaged, that you were top-heavy, needed to get rid of some folks, you don't agree with that?
And
you
just, no.
You I think that was due diligence?
Absolutely. That was a consultant that they hired that didn't come in and spend as much time as would have been helpful, and we weren't involved in talking with them when they prepared the reports or anything like that. So,
thank you. Mr. Chair, I have one final question.
All right.
Ms. Fowler, this one really disturbed me. I don't need my glasses to read. I'm going to need them to see you. I have an Oregonian article dated July 21, 2004, and it was says, ruling takes Eastside PUD proposal off the ballot, and a judge had ruled that the folks who were trying to establish a people's utility district couldn't get on the ballot. In that article, your government affairs manager, I assume he's still on the job, Dean Funk, sent an email out, and let me read that email to you, and it's pretty shocking. It says, stick a fork in it. You're done. Funk wrote in an email sent to at least two public power supporters, justice prevails under rule of law. Why don't you find something constructive to do instead of dividing a community and breaking up a company that has served the state for a century? That's pretty shocking coming from management when you've told us here that your company is really great employees, and I'm sure they are. I have questions about management here. That's not an appropriate email. That's not an appropriate thought to have about a group of citizens who think they have a better idea about how to run this utility. Could you please respond whether this man is still on the job and whether you support that kind of conversation and attitude about the people in the state?
Yes, Dean is still on the job, and we absolutely do not support that. He was very apologetic. We had a lot of discussions about performance. I think what it does show is maybe the pressure that some of our employees have been under or how they feel like we're being attacked from all sides. And I think particularly going through the PUD measures that we had to in several counties, and this one in particular that didn't look like there was a legal basis to be even on the ballot, and when finally there was victory reached about it not being on the ballot, there was an inappropriate response to it, and he made a terrible mistake, and he was very apologetic, wrote a formal apology to the people involved, and realized that he made a mistake, and we all do that from time to time, hopefully not to that extent, but it's, I think it's a good indication of the pressure and what people have been feeling when you feel like nobody is your friend, everybody hates you because everybody's trying to take a piece of things right now. No excuse, but sometimes it leads to those emotional reactions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Fowler. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to just get information from you. If OPUC does not denies the approval, there are two options. I know that Enron can sell stocks to another party, but there also on the table is PGE may, and this is what I want you to explain to me, not taking a position on it, but explain to me. PGE may issue new common stock to holders of claims. Now, I also want to know, how could consumers become owners of PGE?
Okay. I'm going to let Jim Pyro address that specifically.
The way it would work, again, as Enron explained, is we would issue new stock and would be put in a liquidating trust and distributed to the creditors. Once that happens... Yes.
Can you explain who the creditors would be? Explain that to me.
Creditors are like banks who loaned money to Enron or people who had claims against Enron who loaned Enron money are now trying to get some value back for what they invested in Enron at the time. Yeah, not the old shareholders. The old shareholders are essentially without value here. So it's the people who lent money to Enron who ultimately may get some satisfaction of their claim against Enron. What they'll get in our situation is they get some of our stock. What we'll do with the stock, most likely, is listed on a publicly traded exchange like the New York Stock Exchange. So our stock would be listed. If a consumer wanted to go to that exchange, they could buy stock through their broker and own Portland General Electric stock again. And that's how they could own it. Historically, utilities have had stock issuance plans and some reissued plans, so consumers could buy stock, but initially on, the creditors would own the stock. They'd have a certificate that would say, 100 shares of PGE stock, and if a creditor said, I want to sell the stock and get the money, then he'd go to the exchange and offer to sell, and there'd be a buyer, and if a consumer wanted to buy that stock, they could buy it at whatever the fair market price of that stock would be.
Could employees buy
it? Employees could buy it also. Stock could be, again, distributed as part of compensation plans if that was decided by the board. But over time, as the stock got distributed, it'd be widely traded like it was prior to Enron owning the company, and people could own the stock as a general, just part of their portfolio. So you, as an individual, said, if I want to own Portland General Electric stock, you'd go to your broker, say, I want to buy the stock. He'd buy it for you at the price, and then you would hope the company would do well. We would pay out profits on that stock, just like you invest in Intel or any other company that you might want to buy the stock of.
Mr. Chair, yes. I just want the committee to be aware that, everyone's talking about the public purchase. There's also this option also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For the record.
Senator Montes Anderson, on that same topic, I think the explanation is correct, and I know what you're trying to get at. That would be a way in which PGE would then be owned again, essentially as a private utility. The problem is, of course, is that those liabilities would also go with that stock, and that would be reflected in the value of the stock. You know, it may not be worth very much. And then if anyone were to accumulate any substantial stake in that, then they would have to go through the PUC and others to do that. So it is an option, but it's not without difficulty to once again make a PGE whole. But it is possible.
A follow up: are there other situations that you're aware of where this happened to a company?
Not to my knowledge, but it's not unusual in a bankruptcy that assets are distributed and given to creditors. So that part is normal, but in our case, not.
And what kind of risks are we talking about?
Well, I think what Chairman Metzger is talking about is the liabilities that are against the company that we report in our 10-K. Things like the employee grievance that we have against the company. There are claims related to trading in California. There's the Trojan liabilities out there. So we have a number of liabilities that we disclose in our 10-K. And those things will work out over time. And regardless of whether owned by the creditors or owned by Oregon Electric, those things will settle out over time.
So Oregon Electric would still have the same issue?
Except to the extent they're not indemnified. In the agreement between Oregon Electric and Enron, there are certain indemnifications for certain liabilities. Not all liabilities, but for certain ones that are described in the agreement.
Thank you.
Part of the thing, Senator Monis Anderson, is that with the PUC, they are able to put a corral around some of those liabilities as part of an agreement. But not all of them, but in some cases, some of those, yes. Other questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fowler, I know this has been a very trying time for both the employees and the management, and I think the citizens of the PGE area. One question just on the PUD campaign, because I found myself generally sympathetic to the cause and was going to sign up on your side, not that it would have made any difference in the outcome of the election at all, but then I saw how the campaign was waged, and I found, and that's what I wanted to ask, is the rationale behind it. I mean, what I remember most vividly was stop the government takeover at a time when public services, schools, and higher education down here are so critical to the economic development of the state and just the general well-being of the state. When I saw that campaign rolled out and amplified on television and radio, I found it to be very effective to win the battle, but very ineffective to win the war, which is to really engender a better conversation with Oregonians about what government provides and what we don't provide. And just, I guess, curious as to the rationale of running a campaign that I felt, and I ended up voting on the side that y'all advocated, mainly because I thought the PUD proposal was very poorly thought out and disorganized, but very curious as to the rationale of using what I think was almost the nuclear option to defeat a PUD effort and turn some allies, in effect, much more, I guess, sympathetic to folks that would advocate now for a public power.
I can tell you we had a lot of discussions around that, but we're probably like most people when it comes to a campaign. We want to win, mm-hmm. and we listen to the campaign advisors and we do what we need to do, because this was a very important issue to us and not one that we could afford to lose, because we felt if we lost, it would cause even more damage to the company. So we did everything that we could to win.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, just on that, I guess on that point, and transferring over to the due diligence effort, because you did, it was effective, and the battle was won, but now we find ourselves in a PUC deliberation, and then a greater question, I think, for more than just the city of Portland, but for the entire state, about what type of utility we would like to have. And for me, I was one that was rare for me, kind of, I think, tracking public opinion on this, generally supportive of TPG's efforts and a private ownership offer for TPG. And then I read the due diligence report. And to me, and I have not heard an explanation both from PGE, and I know we'll hear from Dr. Kohler that, following you, I haven't heard an explanation that really meets the acid test, because to me it wasn't exhaustive. It was due diligence. It was certainly well researched, well thought out, and seemed to provide a track record of where TPG was headed in terms of this endeavor. And I don't know if it gave you pause. It certainly gave me a great deal of pause. And then I reflect upon folks in Seattle and Eugene that own businesses and residents there, and I look at the experience they're having with their utilities and have heard generally favorable comments. And so then I reflect upon the due diligence and this campaign, and now find myself, just as one Oregonian, more receptive than I've ever been to getting a group together at a state level, working with our industrial customers and our residents to find that public ownership opportunity. And I would welcome comments or a rationale of why that is not in the best interest, ultimately, of Oregonians at this point.
Well, that's the question I always ask myself is, what's the benefit to the customer, and how can customers' prices go down, or how can customers have better service? And I think both public and investor-owned utilities do a great job of providing reliable service and providing reasonable prices. And I guess I'm just not convinced that changing from investor-owned to a public with a company that's been an investor-owned for a long time makes a lot of sense. Nor would it make a lot of sense to take a public and turn it to an investor-owned if there truly aren't benefits there for the customers. And I don't see those benefits. I don't know how you get at those price decreases people talk about. We work very hard to manage the company and to work on performance and benchmark and do the right things for customers. And it's not an easy job to come up with those kinds of savings to give those kinds of discounts that people talk about. And in terms of the due diligence, they weren't close enough to the operation. I can give you one example. They talked a fair amount about our Beaver plant and how it could be operated with half the people it has. Well, they didn't go down and look at that plant and realize how critical it is to our system and how we operate that plant as a swing plant for us all the time. And if we cut the people there, that plant wouldn't be able to operate for us when we really need it. We use it to make up for when we have low hydro. And so it was pretty clear to me that they weren't close enough. Maybe the money that was spent was more for the financial modeling and those types of things. But as they looked at the company and our performance, they essentially looked at FERC Form 1 data, which is a very superficial look. They did it for the year 2002, which was a very unusual year for utilities. It's really hard to compare apples to apples, and there just wasn't adequate information there for them to make those kinds of conclusions. But consultants are hired to do these kinds of things and say these types of things for due diligence reports. So I was disappointed, but it wasn't a huge surprise to me because that's what due diligence is all about. Mm-hmm. And I do look forward to getting to correct that if we ever are part of this company and work with them to help them understand.
Mr. Chair, and again, I'm glad you're in that chair and I'm in this chair, at least for the next 4 or 5 months.
And then I'd probably
reverse. Well, this has been an interesting place to be, too, with our budget. But to me, and I understand what you're saying on the due diligence report, but to me, it just doesn't pass the smell test that they would come in and not be serious about the type of Herculean effort that they're going to and the financial stakes that are at play. I'll just say it, what I believe is I believe what they wrote, which is that this company would most likely be turned over in a relatively short period of time, and the net losers, and I have no qualms with investors in TPG because I think that's what you invest in stock to do, maximum return. But I think, to me, then I start looking, weighing who's the net losers, and I look at whether it's the fellow down that are the smelter on the Willamette River or some of the high-tech users out in my neck of the woods or low-income residents. To me, that is, and I guess I just offer that up as...
Well, I kind of go back to that the OPUC really has the authority to keep that from happening. Mm-hmm. And if they could keep it from happening with Enron, I think they can keep it from happening with anyone. That's probably where I get my comfort because I really think the OPUC has the authority and works really hard to do a good job of protecting customers.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Dr. Peter Kohler, please.
You don't have any dog in this.
Chairman, members of the committee, I am Peter Kohler. here today in my capacity as the proposed chair of Oregon Electric Utility Company, the entity that has applied to acquire PGE. Should our application be approved by the Oregon Public Utility Commission, I would chair the PGE Board of Directors. I'm joined today by Thad Miller, who is General Counsel for Oregon Electric, and Lisa Rackner, attorney for Oregon Electric and TPG in the OPUC process. I will address my role as prospective chairman of PGE and that of the future board of directors. Thad will address the very vigorous approval process that has been conducted by the commission, and we will then certainly be happy to answer your questions. When asked to take on this responsibility, I gave careful and thorough consideration, consulting with many people, colleagues, friends, and others whose opinion I respect. My first responsibility, as you know, is to Oregon Health and Science University, an institution I've been privileged to lead for over 16 years. I also believe, however, that we in higher education have a responsibility for broader community leadership outside of our institutions. Portland General Electric is a vital part of Oregon's economic, cultural, and community life. It is an institution that has been unfortunately involved in the Enron debacle and as a result faces an uncertain future. I agreed to serve on the PGE board because I felt I could help bring stability to PGE and because I felt that I would be part of a new, strong board that could guide and assist PGE in providing excellent customer service at the lowest possible rates. I'd like to spend just a minute describing the others from our region who have agreed to join me on this new PGE board. And two of them are in the room today. Kirby Dias, who is here, is the principal with Austin Capital Management, LLC, where she assists and invests in early-stage companies in the Pacific Northwest. She recently retired from Intel Corporation, where she was corporate vice president and director of operations for Intel Capital, Intel Strategic Investment Group. She is also a member of the Oregon Board of Higher Education and serves as that board's representative to the OHSU board. Maria Idle is president of the Nike Foundation and previously served as vice president and senior advisor for corporate responsibility for Nike. She is on the board of Business for Social Responsibility, an organization that promotes corporate social responsibility among global companies. Gerald Grinstein is the CEO of Delta Airlines. He served on the staff of former Senator Warren Magnuson from the state of Washington and more recently as chairman and CEO of Burlington Northern. He has served as president of the Board of Regents of the University of Washington and on the boards of the Seattle Foundation and Long Live the Kings, an organization whose mission is to restore wild salmon to the waters of the Pacific Northwest. Dwayne McDougall is the former president and CEO of Willamette Industries. He now serves on several corporate boards, including West Coast Bancorp, Cascade Corporation, Greenbrier, and North Pacific Companies. He has also served as chair of the Oregon State University Foundation and on a number of nonprofit boards. Robert Miller is the chair of Rite Aid Corporation and former CEO of Fred Meyer. Bob formerly served on the boards of Pacific Corps and Scottish Power. He has been active in United Way of the Columbia Willamette and serves on the board of a number of Oregon companies. Lee Pelton is the president of Willamette University here in Salem. Lee is one of the remarkable young leaders in America's higher education system, and he has become one of Salem's leading citizens. He serves on the board of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, the Oregon Symphony, the Oregon College Savings Plan, and the Oregon Council for the Humanities. Tom Walsh, who is also in the room today, is president of Tom Walsh & Company, a builder of affordable housing located in Portland. Tom has served as chair of the Oregon Board of Forestry, as general manager of TriMet, and a number of state boards and commissions. In addition to these independent board members from our region, we would be joined on the PGE board by Peggy Fowler, CEO of PGE. From beyond our region, we would have nationally recognized utility expert Jerry Jackson. He is the former public utility commissioner from Arkansas and a former senior utility executive in the Entergy Corporation, an electric utility serving five states. Finally, we would be joined by two partners of the Texas Pacific Group, David Bonderman and Kelvin Davis. TPG is one of the country's leading private equity investment firms, and it is providing the majority of the investment for this transaction, and Oregon has been its largest investor. This board will brings a strong background in customer service and a clear commitment to the community, as well as the desire and ability to lead PGE out of the period of Enron ownership. Upon the close of the transaction, this board will lead a comprehensive review along with management with the goal of identifying efficiency and productivity gains that ensure customers receive safe and reliable electricity as cost-effectively as possible. And Thad Miller will comment later on the due diligence report you've asked about. I would like to comment on the PGE board's role in governing PGE. The PGE board will function as any other board of directors and will be vested with all the rights typically granted to such boards. It will meet regularly to receive, review, and consider management reports and recommendations, establish board committees, and offer guidance and direction to management, establish medium and long-term strategies for the company, and make decisions on investment, purchases, and sales of property. The board will be responsible for evaluating the performance of executive management. It will provide guidance and direction to management on various matters, including environmental and renewable energy initiatives, labor relations, community relations, customer service relations, and working with community, customer, and other special interest groups to assure corporate consideration of local concerns. It is true that most major financial decisions will be subject to TPG's consent. Some of our detractors have suggested that this means the board of directors will be puppets of the TPG. This is simply not the case. First, boards of directors are always accountable to their shareholders. Moreover, it is very common in the corporate world for boards of directors' decisions on important matters to be referred for ratification by the shareholders. In fact, under Oregon state law, certain board decisions are automatically referred to shareholders. This does not suggest the board does not act independently in the first instance. On the contrary, board members always have obligations to exercise their best judgment on all matters. The prospective PGE board will fulfill this obligation and will do so as long as it serves. Second, the makeup of this prospective board should give you comfort. Tom Walsh and I work closely with Kelvin Davis of TPG to identify prospective board members who are successful business and civic leaders. These individuals have not earned their success by deferring to others' judgment on important matters. They have succeeded by thinking and acting independently, and that is precisely what we will all do as members of the PGE board. Also, I'd like to make a couple of comments about TPG that I also hope might be reassuring. Throughout the business investment world, TPG has earned an excellent reputation for solid stewardship of the companies in which it invests. However, TPG does not engage in micromanaging these companies. Rather, TPG's reputation is built on its practice of appointing strong boards of directors and senior management, if such management is not already in place, as it is in this case, and allowing the management and the boards to run the companies in which it is invested. To the extent TPG participates in management, it is through its seats on the board of directors. Over the past 6 months, I have spent a great deal of time learning about TPG and talking with TPG's principal, Kelvin Davis, about TPG's investment philosophy and history and its goals for PGE. Based on what I have learned, I firmly believe that TPG will indeed prove a responsible steward for PGE through its participation on the PGE board of directors. Finally, I want to echo something that I understand Chairman Beyer said to you last Thursday when he appeared before this committee. The legislature has given the OPUC board, OPUC, broad powers that allow it to ensure that PGE will continue to provide reliable electricity to its customers at just and reasonable rates. Thus, the commission has the ability to oversee the service quality provided to PGE customers, and importantly, the commission sets the rates the PGE's customers pay. And while rates may be higher today than they have been in the past, the commission exercises its authority to ensure that they are no higher than is just and reasonable given PGE's cost. The commission exercises these broad powers over PGE today and will continue to do so to protect PGE customers if Oregon Electric's proposal is approved. And again, the OPUC must also approve any sale to any private entity. Mr. Chairman, the process for acquiring an investor-owned utility in Oregon is extensive and thorough. The commission has the responsibility of determining whether the sale will serve the public utility's customers in the public interest. Our application was filed with the OPUC over 10 months ago, and the OPUC has provided extensive opportunity for individuals, trade groups, corporations, and public advocacy groups to participate. I believe their participation has improved our proposal, and I also believe the Commission has the information necessary on which to base a sound decision. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. Thad Miller will now discuss the Commission approval process.
We'll go with Mr. Miller first so that we can have uninterrupted questioning. Mr. Miller, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Good afternoon. As Dr. Kohler said, my name is Thad Miller, and I am the General Counsel of Oregon Electric, and I've been involved in this proposed transaction almost from the beginning. I am speaking today on behalf of Oregon Electric and all of the applicants in the Commission proceeding who have asked the Commission to approve Oregon Electric's proposed purchase of PGE. We understand the primary purpose of these hearings is to gather information to determine if there is any role for the legislature with respect to future applications to acquire utilities, including providing the Commission with additional tools in its future review of such applications. We are here today to provide you with as much information as possible about our process so that it will help inform you about what you are considering. We agree with Chairman Metzger that the proper forum for the discussion of the merits of our proposal is with the OPUC, with the Commission. For that reason, we will respect the Chairman's request to refrain from commenting on the substance of our proposed acquisition. This has been a long journey for Texas Pacific Group and Oregon Electric, one which started well before the application was filed in March of 2004. Included in the materials that we've handed out today is a timeline of events, which goes back to the beginnings of this transaction. As you will see, Enron has been trying to sell PGE since 1999, long before it was in bankruptcy. In August 2002, as part of the bankruptcy process that subsequently evolved, Enron initiated a formal auction process. Over 200 entities were contacted, and 37 signed confidentiality agreements, which allowed these entities access to information about PGE in order to evaluate the potential purchase. And Senator Deckard, if I could just briefly allude to your questions earlier, it's in this context that you need to understand the due diligence efforts that took place. The underpinnings of those due diligence efforts were very limited access to information and personnel of the company. And I'm happy to answer questions after I'm finished with the rest of my presentation to help you understand that better, if that suits you. All those folks were given the opportunity to bid on PGE. None of the other entities offered proposals that were acceptable to Enron's creditors. And it was Enron's creditors who essentially, the folks acting on their behalf, who were making the decision here. So on November 18th of 2003, Enron signed an agreement with Oregon Electric to sell the shares of PGE to Oregon Electric. But even that didn't end the process of the sale of PGE. Rather, in the bankruptcy process, the bankruptcy court said to the world, anyone who wants to come in and top that bid by certain criteria could do so. So we had the initial auction in which 200 people were given notice. We had the subsequent bankruptcy notice to the world. And the only entity who surfaced at the end of the day willing to buy PGE was Texas Pacific Group through Oregon Electric. On February 5th, the bankruptcy court said that this is the sale from Enron to Oregon Electric that we endorse and adopt. Accordingly, in March of 2004, some 9 months ago, 10 months ago now, we filed an application with the Oregon Public Utility Commission for approval. That process, our proposal to purchase PGE, has been an extremely rigorous and thorough process. We are confident that the Commission, its staff, and the interveners in that process had every opportunity to review all of the details of this sale and that the interest of PGE's customers, foremost, have been more than adequately represented. As you heard from Chairman Beyer last Thursday, under Oregon law, the Commission's task is to determine whether the purchase will serve the public utility's customers in the public interest. We, Oregon Electric, bear the burden of persuading the Commission that our proposal does that. With that backdrop, I'd like to just briefly introduce you to the players, which is the other submission that comes along with my presentation, which is a graphic illustration of the various applicants. Oregon Electric Utility Company, which you see in the middle of the page, is the primary applicant and will be the owner of 100% of the shares of PGE. Oregon Electric, in turn, is owned by several different investors. On the left-hand side at the top, you see the TPG applicants. Those are the TPG funds. Those TPG funds are essentially funds managed by Texas Pacific Group with investments from pension funds. As Dr. Kohler mentioned, one of the principal investors is the Oregon pension fund itself, as well as many other state pension funds, corporate pension funds, and university endowments and the like. In the center are what we call the local applicants. The local applicants are Dr. Kohler, Gerald Grinstein, Dwayne McDougall, Bob Miller, and Tom Walsh. All will be investors in managing member, which in turn will be an investor in Oregon Electric. And finally, parties that are not applicants in the Public Utility Commission process are the passive investors, the Gates Foundation and another private equity fund. They do not have any voting rights with respect to this transaction, and therefore they don't need to be applicants. I heard at one point a question about why all these folks are applicants. The reason is, and again this goes to what you're reviewing, the process and the tools that the PUC have at their disposal. The PUC not only is required to approve the purchase by someone who's going to control PGE, they're obligated to approve the purchase of anyone who's going to influence PGE, which is a much lower standard. So that's why the TPG applicants, even though they won't have voting control, are applicants here. Now, I would like to move on to a discussion of the process that we went through. And just to give you a quick overview, we're talking about multiple parties. We're talking about multiple public hearings and public meetings. We're talking about massive amounts of disclosure, both disclosure of answers to written questions as well as documents. We're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of written testimony. We're talking about oral deposition. We're talking about live hearings at which the commissioners were present and asked questions of everyone. We're talking about closing argument. We're talking about briefs after that process. And in parallel with all that, we are talking about formalized settlement discussions that the PUC oversees through its staff that allows the parties to engage in possible settlement discussions. It's a very robust process, so I'd just like to give you examples of why and walk you through why we think this is a very effective process as it stands today. After our application was filed last March, other parties and interested persons were given an opportunity to intervene. In total, 46 parties, including individuals, trade groups, corporations, public advocacy groups such as the Citizens Utility Board, applied and were granted full intervener status. Commission staff was also an active participant in the proceedings. These parties had the right to participate in every aspect of the case. The Commission also sought the input of PGE's customers and members of the general public. The Commission scheduled 5 open houses, public meetings, I should say, at which members of the public had an opportunity to ask questions of the staff, of PGE, and of the applicants. And those public citizens could make public comments that were then forwarded to the commissioners for consideration. The members of the commission also held 2 public hall meetings and received testimony from many members of the public who chose to speak at those town hall meetings. We now move to another phase of this process. The disclosure process began almost immediately after we filed. During this stage of the case, Commission staff and interveners had the right to take depositions and to send data requests to Oregon Electric. Data requests are requests for information and documents related to the transaction. The vast majority of the data requests were served by staff and the interveners, required Oregon Electric to provide substantive answers to questions, responses that required evaluation of complex technical, financial, and other matters. In addition, the requests required Oregon Electric to produce thousands of documents relevant to its proposal to purchase PGE. In total, Oregon Electric responded to 563 data requests and produced 28,700 pages of responsive documents. Another important part of this process was the filing of written testimony. All 48 parties had the opportunity to submit written testimony regarding the transaction. Staff, PGE, Oregon Electric, Enron, and 14 other parties submitted testimony. The Commission received 2,000 pages of testimony over four rounds, which included direct, rebuttal, surrebuttal, and, believe it or not, surrebuttal testimony. These rounds of testimony served as a written debate by which staff and the interveners raised questions and concerns about the purchase. Oregon Electric then responded to those questions and concerns, and staff and interveners commented on those responses. Each issue raised was fully addressed through this process. Throughout the summer and fall of 2004, settlement negotiations, as I mentioned before, and workshops were held that included Commission staff and interveners. Seven settlement conferences were held over 10 days. Though we were disappointed not to reach a settlement in this matter, the information that was exchanged during those settlement negotiations was invaluable. Hearings were held in this matter on October 20 and 21st, at which time any party who wished to cross-examine witnesses could do so. Importantly, the commissioners were present for both days of the hearings. The commissioners were also present on December 13th and 14th when the parties were given the opportunity to present oral argument and the commissioners had the opportunity to ask questions of the parties. 15 parties in all, including PGE, Enron, Oregon Electric, Citizens Utility Board, AOI, and ICNU, and other advocacy groups and individuals presented oral argument before the Commission over those 2 days. And the Commission itself engaged in detailed questioning of all those parties. After the hearing, the parties filed two sets of briefs, opening briefs and reply briefs. So what I hope is clear to you is that this has been an iterative process. We think a process that is well designed to encourage applicants like ourselves to listen to what the staff and interveners have to say. As a result of this process, our final proposal to the Commission included a comprehensive package of conditions designed, we believe, to protect PGE's customers and to provide concrete and substantial benefits, including a $43 million rate credit and indemnifications against potentially significant liabilities currently facing PGE. As you've heard from Commissioner Beyer last Thursday, the Commission has broad statutory authority to regulate PGE and protect its customers. Through the acquisition approval process, we have learned that the Commission effectively exercises its authority while balancing the public's interest. The Commission has implemented processes that allow all interested parties to come to the table and to be heard. I think it's important because, you know, we're applicants in this process, and of course you might expect us to say it's been a very robust and good process. So I thought it would be helpful just to cite some external examples from any of the interveners in this room, from the Commission itself, or from us as applicants. This same kind of process was gone through when Enron purchased PGE some years ago. And as we all know, what happened with Enron is they went into bankruptcy. Prior to that, when the Enron approval process was underway, many of the same issues were brought up that are being brought up in our process. And the Commission at that time decided, with the cooperation of the interveners and the applicants, to put into place so-called ring-fencing measures to protect the utility from its parent owner. And Standard & Poor's, which is a recognized authority for evaluating the creditworthiness and other characteristics of many companies, including utilities, cited the ring-fencing measures put in place by this commission as the reason that PGE survived the Enron bankruptcy. Fitch Ratings, another well-known rating agency, in fact praised this commission's current structure as being the, quote, poster child for effective regulatory ring-fencing, close quote. The point of all that is, I think you have a very robust process here. You have a commission which discharges its duty to the ultimate, to the point that it's getting praise from independent third-party groups about the efficacy of its measures. Finally, leaving the process itself to some extent, I would like to comment on an issue that has received much attention in the press recently. The issue of the confidential designation of documents in the PUC process. Soon after our application was filed, the administrative law judge assigned to this case issued a standard protective order, one of the commission's standard rules, to protect documents that any party might produce which contained confidential information and trade secrets. As Chairman Beyer explained last Thursday, the issuance of the standard protective order is routine in commission cases, and documents submitted as confidential under such an order are not secret documents, as they have been characterized. Any party can have access to these confidential documents simply by signing the protective order, and there is no limit on the number of party representatives or experts that can have access to the information simply by signing that order. In this case, 131 people signed that order. Each of these people have then had full access to all the confidential documents filed in the case. This includes the right not only to view the confidential information, but also to question the applicants about the information through data requests, briefs, and oral arguments to the commission. Although the confidential information is protected from duplication or exposure to the public generally in order to maintain the commercial value of the information, it is by no means secret. It's known to all the parties to the proceeding and to the commission. Thus, we respectfully submit that you can have confidence that the process allowed by the commission and all of the allowed the commission and all of the parties access to the information they needed to fully consider all the relevant issues. In concluding, I would like to say that Oregon Electric's proposal to acquire PGE has undergone an exhaustive and rigorous review process that has given the commission all of the information it needs to reach a fair and just decision. The numerous parties in this case have had access to an immense amount of information about every aspect of the proposal to purchase PGE. If you are concerned that the commission has not had an opportunity to review some aspect of this transaction, please let me assure you that from our perspective, having produced all those documents, we do not believe that is the case. The commission will make its decision about this transaction having the benefit of thousands of pages of testimony, reams of documents and data responses, and a thorough vetting by the interested parties. The commission has all of the tools it needs to make a sound decision. Not only has this process given the commission the opportunity to learn about our proposal, but it has given us the opportunity to learn about PGE, its customers, and the regulatory process. We have listened and we have learned from the commission staff, from CUB, from ICNU, and from the other interveners. If given the chance, Oregon Electric will be a better owner of PGE as a result of having participated in such a robust process. Thank you for the opportunity of speaking here today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Miller. Do you have any comments? Are you there to make sure they don't say something they're not supposed to? And that's an affirmative response. Thank you very much. Dr. Kohler, I have a couple of questions, and then I'll open it up to again to the committee. Two things. In your testimony, you specifically emphasize the strength of the board. You say it's a new strong board and bringing stability to PGE. There is as you mentioned in your testimony, a lot of concern that the board itself really is transparent in terms of its ability to actually govern the utility. And I think you said yourself that all boards of directors, particularly those with their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, which is TPG, will ultimately call those shots. And as we look over your board, and I'm very impressed, and thank you, Mr. Walsh, for being here today, I commend a lot of the great things that the people from Oregon who are represented on that board have brought to the state and can understand why they want to be on the board. But with all due respect, I think you can see why people would say that you gentlemen do not bring any utility expertise to this board. You do bring a lot of political influence to the board. And it would seem that the end result is primarily that it's political influence for this particular transaction as opposed to governing the utility. And I'd like to have you comment on that because as I wrestle with that, I come to the same conclusion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This board is made up of people who are good businessmen and who make good decisions. If I look at corporate boards, including utility boards around the country, there is an effort usually to have representatives of the best of the large customers on those boards. Boards of utility companies are not necessarily made up completely of people who work in the utility area themselves. I think they're meant to give a broader perspective on what goes on there and to work with management in terms of making sure the company runs better. We do have expertise on the board. We have Jerry Jackson, who has extensive experience, and Bob Miller himself has been on both PacifiCorp and Scottish Power Board. So we do have some representation on there, but I would submit the board is really there as a governance board to work with management to make it a better company, and the expertise to do that exists with this group. There are people making very tough decisions all the time on this board. Witness Jerry Grinstein and Delta Airlines, for example.
Well, let's follow up with that a little bit. You've heard the discussion, and I know you have read and had, I'm sure with others, had discussions about, as we look at what our role might be in some of the rate-setting parameters that the Public Utility Commission could use for investor-owned utilities. And we had a discussion earlier about the taxation, particularly the customers that you would now be your customers if this purchase were to go through. And as we look to the net benefit to ratepayers, and I think I used a comment, it looks like a net fleece, and I want to ask you about that, because you see the value of providing good electric service at a reasonable rate, but you also understand your responsibility to the TPG Board of Directors as well. Do you believe that it is responsible for this utility or any utility to have as part of the business plan, you know, building the bottom line on the basis that you have a legal opportunity to collect taxes from the rate-paying public with no general intention to forward them on to the tax collecting organizations?
Well, I heard the answers that Jim Pyro and Peggy Fowler gave you on that question. Let me just mention, to be sure it's clear, in this particular case, if this is successful, Oregon Electric is successful, PGE will once again be an Oregon taxpaying entity because it will not be consolidated with any out-of-state or other entity belonging to TPG. The only consolidation will be with Oregon Electric, which is itself part of the process. So if this goes through, the taxes, and we can get into how much is appropriate, I think Peggy addressed that very effectively, but it will again become a taxpaying entity both to the state and to the federal government.
Okay, let me follow up on that. That was a very important point you just said. Because under this scenario, this particular scenario, PGE is the only business of the Oregon Electric Company that you would have. It would be the only business. There are no other businesses. So are you saying and assuring the public here that then under the scenario that on this particular sale, that Oregon Electric would indeed file a non-consolidated tax return for its only entity, Portland General Electric?
Well, those two will be consolidated. They will file a return, and they will pay taxes.
One final question before I turn over to members, and this one does have another issue of concern. The members of the board are very prominent in the Oregon community, and as I mentioned before, have had a lot of success in a lot of good works, including your work at Oregon Health Science University. And part of that and obviously is bringing that goodwill to this particular sale, is to be able to tap into that for the confidence for the public and the rate-paying public in particular, and the state, which our committee is charged with, in addition to business and utilities, is the economic development of the state, and having a viable electric utility is part of that. A few weeks ago, when the information came out in the newspapers regarding some of the documents that were placed into the newspaper and much public discussion about those. And I won't go into that again. I'm trying to restrict that as well, and I do understand that's a small part of a very large large picture. But one of the values that I see for all of you being brought into the board of directors was to provide that confidence, that leadership. And I would say that in the immediate time when those documents came out until we're here today, we heard nothing from the new leader of Oregon Electric or Mr. Walsh or anyone else about an issue that was prominent in the discussion and the minds of the citizens for the last 2.5 weeks. And my concern would be, is this the type of leadership we would anticipate from the board on difficult decisions that people just disappear and we don't hear any response, any observations, any context from those who are to be the voice of this utility?
Right. I guess it's a Mr. Chairman, if I may respond, it is a legitimate question how vocal we should be at this point in the process. I would say that there has been repeated and echoed again in another newspaper article the fact that the board was silent. The board was not silent. I was called on one day. I ended up the next day on all three television channels. I know that other members of the board talked to other people, and we did, in fact, have an op-ed piece in the Oregonian on that Friday, to the point of why we thought the TPG offer was an appropriate one for the state and for PGE. So I think maybe we weren't vocal enough, but in fact we were speaking out, and the question is how much time do we have to do that with everything else that we're doing, but I think we will have adequate time to devote to PGE should this be approved, and we in fact want to be sure that this board, with so many local people on it, Oregonians and people who work in Oregon, are in fact a communication. We will be able to hear from people who have concerns about PGE, what it might be doing, and be able to be responsive to the public at large. So there'll be a much more open process than there has been historically.
Well, I would hope so, because I would just suggest that and observe that this is a communication piece is a critical part of something like this. And above all the values that a group of distinguished Oregonians, as you folks all are, I think that might be your number one mission, is to be able to convey those kind of difficult issues and put them in context.
Just add one comment. I spent about 30 minutes in front of all three television stations. They did not choose my most articulate moments. But I did spend a good bit of time.
You didn't get the
Yeah, we can. No.
It's called repeating the message, right? Questions from the committee. Who would like to begin? Senator Deckard will start this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. I think we can all, A, relate to the speaking to television cameras and hoping for the best when at 5 and 6 and 11. Dr. Cole, you mentioned in your opening that the new board hopefully will give comfort to Oregonians, and certainly I can tell you for myself, and maybe that's a barometer of political influence, but it does. Certainly. The one question that I have is, if we leapt forward and hypothetically the deal's approved in the next 2 months, 6 years from now, if we leapt forward and you're the chair of the board, and OEC or TPG comes and says, we'd like to sell the company, what authority would you have to reject that?
Well, we have, and you've heard us make statements, excuse me,
I haven't,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Decker, we have made comments before to the point that many of us on the board favor an IPO or a gradual release of stock. I think that TPG is coming to the conclusion that that might be a whole lot easier than the process they've just been through here. Remember that sale of this company will require something akin to this if it is to a public entity again in the future. So that is not an easy process to go through. The other thing is, remember as well that the strategy of this purchase is to use the dividends to pay down the debt on PGE in such a way to increase the value of the company. And I would submit that the place where value will be gained will be from that, rather than on the backs of the ratepayers, which I think is what most people are concerned about. That is, again, under the control of the PUC. But my belief is that this is a very long-term process. I guess it's conceivable it could occur within 6 years, but I'm guessing it's going to be considerably longer than that, more to the longer end of the spectrum with regard to the TPG guidelines. They do have to at some point sell part of it at least in order to get money back to the investors.
Mr. Chair, just on that, do you, and perhaps you can't provide precise definition of the authority that you have, but I'm interested, if you can, of are you invested with the authority to say to your partners at TPG, no, we choose, and here is, but ultimately the buck stops on your desk, or that no, we choose to continue with the relationship we have, or is that unclear, or is that not authority?
Well, I think, excuse me again, Senator Decker, the board has all the authority a board usually does in this state. And remember, according to Oregon law, I believe, sale of a company of this size does have to be referred to the shareholders for their approval anyway. In this case, the shareholders would be TPG. As the majority shareholder, so they would in fact be willing. However, I don't see this as a place where we would have a lot of acrimony in deciding what to do. I think the appropriate course will be set in conjunction with TPG and the members of the board who have strong feelings about making sure this works for Oregon. One of the reasons I joined up was I think we need PGE as a strong presence to help spur on and support economic development. Without it, and with a lot of uncertainty, I think we could have a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll be working together.
Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miller, I want to make sure I understand your chart.
Sure.
It's a pretty simple chart, but I'm a little bit confused. Your ownership structure in the middle, you have Oregon Electric Utility, and my understanding of your testimony that Oregon Electric Utility owns 100% of the shares of PGE, is that correct?
If the transaction is approved, yes.
Okay. Thank you. And may I continue? Then, Dr. Kohler, I'm a little confused because you say in your testimony at page 4 that the boards of directors are always accountable to their shareholders. So you and the other general partners investing significant sums of money, I think yours is $500,000 if I read the reports accurately, you're investing that amount of money into Oregon Electric. And by law, the directors represent the shareholders, not the ratepayers. The shareholders are Oregon Electric. So you've got personal financial incentives and legal responsibilities here to make sure that Oregon Electric maximizes its profits. How does that help Oregon ratepayers?
Well, again, the rates being controlled, excuse me, Mr. Chairman and Senator Walker, the rates being controlled by the Public Utility Commission are, in fact, the only way they can be increased. Now, our belief is that by increasing the value of PGE and providing good customer service, and by the way, you heard me mention also the best possible rates, that will increase the value of the company. So I think these are dual responsibilities, but the board certainly does a great deal more than just try to get rates increased. In fact, rate cases only come up infrequently unless they're related to environmental or other issues. But the fact is the board is there really to make sure the company runs well and thereby serves the purpose, which is the delivery of electricity effectively throughout the area.
All right. May I continue,
yes.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Dr. Kohler, you also acknowledged in testimony somewhere, I've got a lot of documents, but not nearly as much as these documents, which when Mr. Miller was testifying, I thought that was pretty funny because this is a pretty visual article and I'm a visual learner. But at some point, you testified that if Congress repeals rules related to utility ownership, i.e. the Public Utility Holding Act, that Oregon Electric essentially no longer has a reason to exist. and the so-called negative consent rights reserve all important decisions for TPG. So how can you claim that Oregon Electric represents local control?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, if the PUCA, so-called PUCA, is repealed, I don't think my testimony said that Oregon Electric would go away. In fact, Oregon Electric will persist. It will still have the same people there. The thing that would go away would be the consent rights from TPG. And TPG would have the controlling shareholder rights, but the consent rights would disappear. That's the major change that would occur. Mr. Miller may want to amplify on any of my answers, or Ms. Rackner here as well, if I get over my head and legally.
I think that is the correct description. You're essentially exchanging one kind of a right for another.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, one final question. Thank you. Dr. Kohler, this is the most curious one. You again testified that you had not read key documents relating to Texas Pacific Group's acquisition of PGE. Did you really mean to say that? And if you did, why didn't you read the documents?
You saw the stack.
I did.
I did read, again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I've got to remind myself to do that every time.
I'm adding to demerits.
Okay. So I did read a large amount of material. I did not read the specific consultant's report because that's just what it was. It was part of the due diligence. It was a consultant's report. And frankly, I knew about it, but did not think it was relevant because our plan, our strategy has been all along that if this is approved, we will be getting together with management. And this consultant's report is pretty outdated. It came along before I even got involved in the process at all. And I believe it had some comparisons there based not on local factors at all, but on other companies around the United States, and that it was not relevant to read through all that material because we'd be approaching it in a coordinated strategic planning type of way in the future, and that material probably would not be used other than just for what it was, some comparison to outside entities. So, by the way, I have now read it all. Just to let you know, I felt like I had to do that over the holidays, and I hated it, but I guess I feel better.
Well, welcome to the club, Doctor. We have a lot of reading ourselves. And, Mr. Chair, one tiny little question came in response.
Okay.
Unlimited. Dr. Kohler, let me ask you this question. Have you ever asked any of your OHSU attorneys to review any of the documents related to Oregon Electric Utility?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me a chance to straighten out the record. It is reported in the newspaper somewhere that I did that. I don't know. I don't believe I ever said. What I said was they reviewed whether it was a conflict of interest for me. They did not review anything related specifically to TPG, Oregon Electric, or PGE. It was really the conflict of interest that they reviewed, and that was all. So I did not have the OHSU lawyers involved in any way other than assuring this was not a conflict of interest for me.
Thank you, Dr. Kohler. It was your own testimony that left that in doubt, and so I appreciate
that. I just spoke if it said that.
Yeah, and because I've seen it. And so I appreciate that you've had the opportunity to clarify, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Monasek.
One brief question, or I'm not sure if it's that brief, but it's my understanding that TBG will have the same various tax loopholes that Enron now has, and that they would be able to do exactly what Enron had done, and that the state of Oregon again will have a corporation in which there are no state taxes being paid because of the assets that they have elsewhere. Could you comment on that?
I would be glad to. That's another, Mr. Chairman, Senator Monis Anderson, this is another good chance to correct the record. That is not true. TPG is an investment firm. It is not a giant conglomerate corporation. There is no other entity, and that's one reason it's set up the way it is, with which to consolidate. I can guarantee you that should this be approved, and assuming, of course, that PGE has a year in which taxes should be paid, they will be paid to the state. They will be paid to the federal government. It will not be consolidated with any external entity belonging to any of the other TPG funds in such a way to avoid taxes. So the loopholes, Enron was an entirely different organization. And I realize that there is an unfortunate fact that Texas is in the name of TPG. I did read
too,
the Mitch message yesterday, and I saw Mitch Greenlick last night and asked him about that. But the fact is that the loopholes, as you described them, that were utilized by Enron will not be a part of the operation of PGE should it belong to Oregon Electric and TPG.
But TPG would also have losses, and that's a part of how you fill out your income tax, corporate tax.
I think there may be a little confusion here, Senator Mona Sanderson, about what you're talking about, losses versus interest deductions and the sort. The tax laws will be the tax laws the same as they were for Enron. Why Enron was paying zero taxes, as the chairman referred to earlier, was because they had net operating losses from other businesses in their larger conglomerate, which they set off against the profits from PGE and therefore had no tax liability. In the case of TPG, when TPG owns this entity, when Oregon Electric owns PGE, they will file a consolidated tax form. TPG will not be consolidated with them. There will be no other businesses to have net operating losses to offset against those PGE profits. However, there will be interest rate deductions, just like you have interest rate on your home mortgage that you deduct from, you know, your income tax. There is interest that Oregon Electric will be paying on the debt that it's raising to buy PGE shares, and those will, under the tax laws and under the auspices of the way the commission policy works, be deducted.
And just follow up, just so that I understand, then you are saying that the losses that I'm sure TPG has losses somewhere, they will not be
consolidated
into with PGE.
Yes, Senator, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just on that point, and this is not a question, it's more of a comment on the whole taxation issue, is that really more is an issue or question to us. Because in many ways, companies are just following the laws that we've enacted and promulgated. And so whether it's any regulated utility or a non-regulated utility, they're simply doing what we as individuals do, which is maximizing or reducing our tax burden. So more, I mean, on that issue, I find the question comes back to us. And Chairman Beyer will be, I know he's working on a white paper, he has a draft of it, and we'll present it to the Senate Revenue Committee in a week or two, just on this very issue of should regulated utilities be treated differently than just a regular traded sector firm for tax law. But I find this whole taxation issue, and certainly the media coverage of it, in some ways has been a little bit disorienting, because most of the companies I found are just following the laws that we've enacted and the tax credits that we've enacted and exercising those tax credits where applicable.
Before I let you go, I want to thank you for coming. I appreciate that very much. I think the taxation issue, again, this has been a good airing of some of these issues, because, again, we're trying to look at what role we do have in that. And as the revenue chairman pointed out, utilities are a little different because we allow them to be tax collectors specifically for the purposes of collecting taxes for state, federal, and local liabilities. And that's why it's an important issue to try to get a handle on where we're going to go with that. I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
Now, members, a couple of things before we move on here. I want you to know that we are we have in the room until 4 o'clock today so that we can conclude this testimony. For those of you in the audience, we all have other committees, including myself, in and out, and we have a lot of members that want to participate. So we're continuing until 4 o'clock. We may have some members going in and out to their own committees, but as opposed to not allowing them to participate at all on some of these questions. So I want you to know that. Secondly,
members, if you indulge me just for a moment here, we have a young lady in the front of the chamber here who is her first day working on behalf of Mr. Roger Martin, and I've kind of put her through an hour and a half, and she was just here to have her little bill introduced as a committee bill dealing with repair of transmission lines in Eastern Oregon, and I'm starting to feel good. Well, I don't need testimony right now.
Oh, make her testify.
But we want to have a first opportunity to that for another time. But I am starting to feel guilty that you're going to sit for 3 hours. So if I could, members, you have LC 1179, and would ask that have a motion to introduce as a committee bill, does not indicate support or rejection of this the bill. It's a utility bill, folks, but has nothing to do with what we're talking about. So and if I could have a motion, I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I know you're well aware of this, but
and you can vote.
I'm
and you
not
can
voting
vote.
Member yeah. of this committee, so just to
yes.
let the audience
yeah.
know.
I move that the committee adopt this as draft legislation.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson has moved the adoption of LC 1179 as a committee bill. Does not indicate support or opposition to the measure. Any discussion?
Is she in favor or does she oppose the merger of TP?
No. Okay. No objection? So ordered. Okay. You may be dismissed if you'd like. Okay. Now I'm going to ask Bob Jenks and Jason Eisendorfer from the Citizens Utility Board, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jenks. I'm Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. With me is Jason Eisendorfer, Cub's legal counsel. Cub was established by initiative petition 20 years ago. We exist in Oregon law, giving us the right to intervene in any proceeding before the PUC to represent residential customers. Our primary source of funding comes from donations from utility customers. The chair asked last week about the role of intervener funding in this proceeding. About two years ago, Cub became eligible for intervener funding. By our count, this is actually the third major case where that's come to bear before the PUC. The first was a Pacific Power rate case, and intervener funding allowed us to hire an expert there. The case settled, but the expert was helpful to us in that settlement process. The second case was Pacific Core's multi-state process that looked at how we allocated power costs between Pacific Core's six states. In that case, we also settled in. Intervener funding is, and in this case, then we've had two, in addition to us being able to hire an expert witness for this, which has been extremely valuable in our analysis of the companies, Oregon Electric and PGE's consolidated debt, the rate of return they would see, the tax windfall they would receive. It has been very valuable. Two other folks in this proceeding also used intervener funding, and we think that that helped make for a much more well-rounded record. I do want to say one thing about intervener funding before I go on, and that's it doesn't put us on equal footing with utilities. What it does is makes the footing a little less unequal. I do want to talk just a little bit about what that outside expert we hired found on the taxes, because I do want to clarify how the taxes work with this. PGE customers under Oregon Electric Texas Pacific's plan would pay PGE's projected taxes. That money would then transfer up to Oregon Electric, and Oregon Electric would get a big interest deduction, like a mortgage deduction for your house, on that tax payment at the Oregon Electric level for the debt they incurred to buy PGE. That deduction is worth about $15 million a year. It's completely forecastable, just as I know what my mortgage deduction is going to be next year and the year after that and the year after that. I can project what Oregon Electric's interest deduction will be at various interest rates going forward. So we know that they're going to save about $15 million on taxes. Now, that's taxes that customers pay PGE that will not find its way to the Oregon revenue, state revenue, and it will not find its way into the federal revenue stream. It will instead be diverted and kept at the Oregon Electric level for the benefit of Oregon Electric and its investors, TPG. And that's important because over 5 years, that's a $75 million benefit for them. It's a cost for customers of excess taxes that we're paying. And I think, Chairman Metzger, you asked the right question in comparing that to the $43 million rate credit. And we asked that very question to the Commission at oral argument. When you weigh those two together, does that come off as a net benefit? How can it be a net benefit when we're funding $75 million in excess taxes and getting $43 million back in a rate credit? So we do think there's a tax issue here, and there is a tax windfall here. It's different than the Enron one, but it's very clear, and it's very forecastable, and it's very real. Over the last decade, Jason and I have been through several of these PUC proceedings concerning the acquisition of Oregon Utility. This one is different than Enron, Scottish Power, and Sierra Pacific, or any of the other ones that have come to play. First, I want to note that one of the differences is that every party to this proceeding that's not a party to the transaction itself is opposed to the application. That's never happened before. Always before, there have been some parties that have joined together with PUC staff and worked out a stipulation and recommended approval. That's not the case here. The second difference is Texas Pacific itself. They are a speculator. They are not buying PGE to own it. They're buying PGE to sell it. This creates a different set of incentives and a different set of risks, a different set of incentives for them and a different set of risks for customers. The question that the committee asked last week was, are the proper tools in place for this commission in dealing with the Texas Pacific application? Are they in place? And are those tools working? In many respects, we won't know this until after we see the commission order. We do believe that the commission has a clear authority that they can reject this proposal, and we think that's what the record before the commission supports, and we think that that's what the commission ought to do. A much more difficult question is, does the commission have the tools that would be necessary to regulate a speculative owner like TPG if this application is approved? We discussed this very question at length during the PUC proceeding, and I don't want to re-argue our case, but I do think it's important to talk about the PUC's regulatory authority and what an owner like Texas Pacific, this new kind of owner, would mean. The commission, as the chair of the commission testified last week, they have broad authority in the 511 in this merger application process, including the authority to put conditions on an acquisition. But the commission has a much more limited authority in the day-to-day normal regulatory process. The problem with this is that the commission can only place conditions on the acquisition now before it's approved. Once the acquisition is approved, the commission cannot add conditions if it later finds those conditions are necessary. We don't have any experience in Oregon, and as Senator Walker pointed out, there's very little experience in the country with this kind of speculator owning a local monopoly utility. Therefore, the commission has to anticipate the business model of Texas Pacific and get every single condition exactly right now, or they'll never get the chance to do that again. When it comes to the due diligence, you've heard today that the due diligence documents don't represent a business plan. But the commission has to take them with a great deal of weight because they're the only documents that we have that give us an insight into the Texas Pacific business model. And Texas Pacific is saying, well, they'll get back to us later after the thing closes with a business plan. But that's too late for the commission. If the commission does not get all the conditions right today when they approve it, they may find it very difficult to regulate Texas Pacific going forward. We disagree with some of what Dr. Kohler said about the role that TPG will take in managing the company. TPG is not a passive investor. They don't sit back and let the board do the work. They're very much, they've been fairly upfront on the record of the commission. They're an active investor. They claim the benefit is a concentrated owner who is an active investor. They will be involved in the decisions about PGE's operation and about PGE's investment. They will provide that kind of advice. There's even testimony before the commission about they proposed a condition that allows them to divert some of the profits they earn on PGE to Texas Pacific to pay for the consultants and expertise that will be giving that advice on operations and in investments at the PGE level. So it's not simply through the board level. There's going to be several million dollars a year of advice being given on these operations from Texas Pacific through Oregon Electric to PGE. That's important because the business model that money is going to be going to, that business model represented by that advice, we believe is focused on cost cutting and reducing investments in the utility. And this is the exact opposite of what is assumed under the regulatory system set up by this legislature and the PUC. Utility investors are expected to make their profits by making long-term investments in power plant and other equipment, mm-hmm. and then earning a profit, a rate of return on those investments over their lifetime, 30, 40, or 50 years. Utility regulations assumes that investors will want to invest in a utility because that's the basis for utility profits. The primary concern that we have under the law is that investors will overinvest, that they'll gold-plate the utility because that's the source of profits. Thus, the primary tool that the PUC has is to deny recovery of an investment. We scrutinize investments and deny the ones that we don't think are appropriate. But the commission has few tools for the opposite circumstance, a short-term owner who doesn't want to make the investments because they're not going to be around for 30 or 40 years to earn that return. The commission does not have the power to tell a utility that it must make an investment in a new power plant, a new transmission line, a new distribution facility, or anything else. The statutes that have been passed by this legislature assume a different kind of owner with a different set of incentives than we're getting with Texas Pacific. While we think highly of the current PUC, we are skeptical that the legal and regulatory framework is in place to oversee Texas Pacific. I wanted to turn it over to Jason to talk a little bit about the voting rights issue, the resale, and then talk a little bit about sort of the statutes and state law. You asked where could there be improvements and to try to specifically address a few of those. Jason?
Thank you. Jason, please.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, attorney with the Citizens Utility Board. And I was going to confine myself to a review of the areas where this committee might look at improvements in the PUC set of authorities, but I got excited during the last panel, and I felt that I needed to make a couple of corrections. I think part of the frustration here is this is obviously an extremely complicated proceeding, and it's very difficult to get sort of a clear message out sometimes, and so I want to take just a few minutes in trying to clarify two particular points I think that Dr. Kohler mentioned. One was on voting rights if PUCA is repealed, and the other is who actually has the say-so in selling PGE. Both issues are quite clear. In the draft operating agreement between the OUC and Texas Pacific, this is the version of the operating agreement that is on the record. Section 3.02D of that document indicates quite clearly that if PUCA is repealed, the local applicant's voting rights in OUC go from 95% to 0.8%. PUCA repeal was a part of the last federal energy bill. That was the energy bill that died because it had too much pork in it. I think there are not a lot of energy experts out there who think that PUCA has long to live. We don't think PUCA repeal is a great idea, but I'm not sure that we can stop PUCA repeal. In our opinion, PUCA repeal, it's not a matter of if, but when, and when it happens, the local applicants have voting rights approaching zero.
Mr. Chair, I need education on what you're talking about when you're saying PUCA repeal.
Can you explain that?
PUCA is a Public Utility Holding Companies Act. It was an act from the 1930s, and its primary it was enacted primarily to make sure, sort of ironically, that speculator owners did not drain cash from utilities. There were a number of defaults and bankruptcies in the 1930s, and that was it creates a set of reporting and other kinds of requirements. Some view PUCA as outdated, and there's an effort to repeal it. Again, if it is repealed and the reporting requirements would not apply to Texas Pacific, obviously, because the act doesn't exist anymore, there really is no need for the pretense of the local applicants and their voting rights, so they disappear. The second issue, which is who gets to sell it, Section 6.04A of the draft operating agreement says that after consultation with the company board and the PGE board, the members holding the majority of the Class B interests, that's Texas Pacific, shall have the right to effect a transfer of all outstanding equity interests in PGE or an initial public offering. It's actually better stated in cross-examination by Richard Schifter, who said on cross-examination that the current draft of the agreement does provide that, in essence, TPG can, in fact, cause either an IPO or another sale of PGE. And there is no ability of the local applicants to stop that, except through persuasion, I suppose. Okay, so those are the two points I wanted to correct. Now, I wanted to address three areas in which this committee might look at examining changes or improvements to the authorities that the PUC might have. The first one is the net benefits issue. This is one that the committee discussed to some degree last Thursday. As I think you all know, ORS 757511 uses the phrase defining the PUC's standard of review, essentially. The phrase is that the application must serve the public utilities customers in the public interest. The term, the standard net benefit, was actually created in UM 1011 in 2001 to mean that the application must provide net benefits to customers and present no harm to the public generally. That order has never been challenged in the courts. And it is conceivable that a reviewing court could find that the commission overreached with that order. And so if the committee is interested in preserving the net benefits standard in law, one of the things they could do is pass legislation amending 757511 and specifically writing net benefit into that statute. A little further beyond that, defining net benefits is a little tricky because I think it is largely on a case-by-case basis and could include things like rate benefits, service quality benefits, stability benefits, environmental benefits, etc. The second area of concern that the committee might want to look at is actually an issue that UM 1011 itself raises. And it was something that we struggled with during this the Texas Pacific process. There's a sentence in UM 1011 that begins, "The form of business enterprise should be of no consequence to the commission." That's the beginning of the sentence. It then goes on to say, "As long as the utility obeys regulatory mandates and procedures, does not present conflicts with the interests of Oregon customers, does not expose customers to greater risks of higher cost or lower service quality, and is capable of economically and reliably providing the services offered to customers now or in the future." In other words, the form of business enterprise is of consequence to the commission because it needs to make sure that all those other bad things don't happen. This is an increasingly this issue is of increasing concern to us. It is, what is it that the commission is allowed to look at? And with the repeal of PUCA, one of the other underlying one of the arguments for those who would have PUCA repealed is, don't worry, the state utility commissions can handle it. This sentence in this order concerns us. I think it is fundamental that, in fact, the form of business enterprise is of consequence to the commission, and it would, I think, benefit ratepayers if the commission accepted that. And the third and final issue is a confidentiality issue. It's the one that this committee has discussed at some length. This case was frustrating to us. primarily because we did see the due diligence documents and we couldn't tell people what they said, to be quite honest. We couldn't discuss the cost-cutting and reduced capital investment there. We couldn't talk about the memos where Texas Pacific was talking about the acceptable level of governance over the OEUC board. And in fact, in our mind, the newspaper stories that have come up subsequent to the revelation, I suppose, wasn't news to us because it's what we said in our testimony. It's just that we were unable to tell anybody. And to be quite honest, the release of that confidential information is something of a blow to the process. Paul Graham with the AG's office last week said that it was the first time in commission history that had happened. And it's a blow primarily not, I suppose, Texas Pacific would think it was a blow. It was a blow as much to us as anybody else. We're not the ones who have access to most of the information. The game is how do we get access to the utilities information. And, in fact, initially when the information was released, we believed that the pendulum was going to swing very much in the wrong direction, that there would be a clampdown on information, when, in fact, over the last couple of years, we think that utilities have come to, and the commission largely, have gotten a little bit lazy with regard to the protective orders. There is no actual need for a showing for the proponent of a protective order on a particular document. And it is simply too much of a burden to ask parties to a process on a document-by-document basis to challenge that. We had decided in December that at the end of this case, we were going to approach the commission and ask that the commission review the protective order process to make sure that the utilities or the proponent of the protected status really does have need a burden of showing that there's a need for it. And when Texas Pacific decided to waive all the rights of confidentiality, which the right was based on commercial trade secrets, when they decided to waive all those rights to the documents in question, it really raised a issue in our mind whether those documents should ever have received that designation in the first place. Mm-hmm. These are the three areas, you know, that we've looked at that I think the committee could choose to examine and further improve the commission process.
Jason, Bob, thank you very much. That's been very helpful, and I really appreciate the context which you've placed things. I do have a couple of questions. Bob, first of all, for you, you talked about how the current law doesn't really deal with someone who would speculate in buying a utility as opposed to someone who wants to run the utility for a long period of time. But let me play the other argument on that. Under the current law, though, since when the, quote, speculator would turn around and want to sell that utility right away, that the prospective purchaser would have to go through the same process and show a net benefit to the public there. I mean, isn't that kind of a protection? Because they can't just turn it over without turning it over to someone else who will even improve, presumably, the net benefit to ratepayers.
Senator Metzger, that's a good question. The commission would have authority over the next resale of the company to protect customers from being sold to an even worse sort of owner. But the real issue I was trying to raise was the operation. How does a speculator operate a utility that might be different than an investor? We think there's greater incentives for cost cutting and greater incentives to not make the investment in the utility because they're not going to be around to make the profits on it. And what the commission doesn't have, so you got a 5 or 7 year window, or maybe it's longer as they're suggesting, but you got a window where you've got an owner whose incentives are not the traditional incentives to invest in the utility, but may well be incentives to not invest. And the commission does have authority over what happens at the end of that period, but what happens during that 5 to 7 to 8 years, does the commission have the authority to make sure that the proper maintenance is being being conducted? Does he have? Do they have the authority to make sure that we're making the investments we need in new power supply, in new distribution facilities, etc.? And that's the concern is the ability to make sure the utility is having the right amount of money invested in it and is being maintained properly during that owner. But you're right. At the end of that ownership, we'll have the commission will have authority over the next one.
Mm-hmm. And, on that same theme, because you know we've had discussions in this committee a number of years ago with a similar situation that you would talk about with telephone providers, US West, now Qwest, and the PUC. His authority was extended there to demand service improvements using that authority. Wouldn't that be the same authority they would exercise here if maintenance things that depreciated service quality and demand as part of their rate making thumb is to demand those increases in service quality?
Right. I think Mr. Metzger, Chairman Metzger, I think that's a perfect analogy. That's an analogy we made in our testimony was the allusions to the problems with U.S. West. If you remember during that period, the commission didn't have the power to say go replace that analog switch that's wore out in Roseburg. The commission was using the bully pulpit. Chairman Eakins was out there publicly holding news conferences, holding public hearings, trying to embarrass U.S. West into making the necessary investment, but what he didn't have is the power to simply order them to say, take out that analog switch that's reached its capacity and put in a new digital switch. And the legislature did talk about and did give the commission increased authority over service quality. What the commission doesn't have is the ability to say, you got to do X, and if you don't do X, we're going to fine you. They have the ability to go to court and seek fines for certain things, but what they don't have is the ability to say, make this investment, and what they don't have is the ability to say, if service goes below X, we're going to fine you directly without going to court. And those are some tools that would have been helpful for the U.S. West circumstance. They would be helpful in this kind of circumstance.
One other question, Gordon, and neither one of you can answer this one. Jason brought it up, but you talked about one of your suggestions was looking at the net benefit standard as placing that into statute. I brought this up Thursday. I would like from one who looks at protecting the residential customer's role in utilities, from your perspective, is the net benefit, let's say that were to be placed into statute, is that significant enough of a definition because it would provide flexibility for the commission to do various things, or is it still too undefined? But from your own perspective, if you were czar of the of ORS, how would you characterize how specific that should be placed into statute?
Mr. Chair, first of all, the first benefit of putting that into statute is that you seal it in statute. It doesn't exist now, and so that would be a net benefit, I suppose. That is an issue that we have struggled over. How do you then define, do you then take the next step and define what net benefits means? I think there is a legitimate argument that says what you want to do is delegate that determination to the commission that has the 15-foot stack of information in front of it. I suppose you could have a partial list of what that means, but a definitive list I think gets us into trouble because each filing is going to be different and each case is going to be different. And so I think delegating some of that authority to the commission to figure out what benefits means, I think in our mind would be the preferable path.
But Senator Metzger, let me also say, I think Jason's right. You could have a list of things to consider. The problem is you don't want to make it exclusive because we don't want to be prohibited from raising an issue in the next one. Mm-hmm. But you could raise the issues of the owner's experience running a utility. There's a series of things that I think you could make issues that and direct the commission to examine in that process.
Okay, my final question then also from your experience. If, and whether it's this case or any other future case, that public ownership of a utility, in this case a very large utility, were to take place here in Oregon, we have a number of, as we know, public utilities run very well. Representatives are here in the audience today, and of course they strongly oppose any PUC oversight over a public utility. But from your perspective, if you were to have a public utility that was so large as Portland General Electric in its territory do you believe or not believe that there should be some PUC-type oversight because of the statute that does, under 757, talks about the statewide interest of utility, and if one had statewide clout and its impact on others, do you believe that there should be a PUC oversight, even of a public utility, of that size?
Chairman Metzger, I know that there are a number of people here from the public utilities, and makes this answer delicate.
I see one of them, you know, getting nervous in the very back right now.
First of all, I would say that the commission does currently have some authority over safety, and there are some areas of the law that the legislature has given the PUC authority over publicly owned utilities. I think the size of a utility, to me, is I think you are asking a relevant and legitimate question. At what point does the size of a utility make that something we would want? The commission and staff has a lot of expertise over utility operations, safety, O&M, investment, and I think that could be useful in trying to understand and oversee even a large publicly owned utility. I also think it makes a difference on the structure and charter of that. If PG was converted into a publicly owned utility but had an appointed board rather than elected board, I think that may lead you to believe that there needs to be more oversight to make sure that that appointed board is the PUC somewhat holds things accountable to the customers, and if you elections do the same thing theoretically with public, so it may be the structure of the board may impact that, the operating agreement, the operating structure. If you have private operation of a publicly owned utility, does that drive you to say you need a larger oversight? So I think there's a lot of questions there. I think it's a legitimate question. I certainly am not one that would say no, because it's public, there's no role for the PUC. Next question. I think that's a legitimate question, and depending on the structure and how something like that would be set up, I think we ought to examine that question, and we ought to talk about it. I'm one that says that I think there's a good chance that we would feel that was appropriate. There is good expertise there, and I think that could be useful in overseeing a large publicly owned utility. And I may not make it out of the room after saying that.
We do appreciate candor. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to remember who was speaking during this period of time. I think it was Mr. Jenks. Yeah, you brought up a question I was going to ask Commissioner Beyer the other day, and that's the distinction about the rate of return. If I understand correctly, there are two types of expenses. There's the regulated recoverable expenses that are used for operations and infrastructure, and those are recoverable from rates, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Then there's the the rate of return, where they invest in equipment and they sort of get a paycheck back from that. Is that correct?
Chairman Metzger, Senator Walker, yes, that's it.
Okay, so your point is well taken about the PUC. One of the things that the Public Utility Commission does not do is they only pass on whether you can make the investment or not. They're not going to tell you to buy a cheaper type of equipment when you want to put more money in an investment because you get more money back on a rate of return, but the PUC is not going to make a judgment call on how expensive your equipment is, are they?
Chairman Metzger, Senator Walker, the commission might. The commission might say you overinvested. You bought a customer information system, a computer system for your customers that's $20 million larger than you need to be, mm-hmm. So we're not going to allow you to put it into rates. Again, the assumption is that the utility may overinvest because of that incentive, so the commission does have the power to second guess it and say no, that investment you made was not prudent. It was more than you need to serve the customers, and that's unfortunate. We're not going to let you bill customers for that. So the commission can second guess an investment, but again, the assumption is they're removing costs, not the other way around. They're second guessing and saying, "Oh, you didn't." I mean, I guess the real issue is what's the commission's recourse? Saying you didn't make this investment that you should have. The commission's recourse is we don't let you put something in rates. Well, if you didn't make the investment, you're not putting it in rates anyway. So what is the commission? So what power does the commission have to make you make that investment, or to make a better investment? And it becomes much more difficult because the normal process of denying recovery of a cost is a hammer against overinvestment and too large of investments. It's not. It doesn't work very well to try to motivate to make that investment to begin with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if I could make the analogy of I am living in my house now, and I'm assuming I'm going to live in it for 20 years, and my roof begins to leak. If I'm assuming I'm going to live there for a long period of time, I might very well go and get a very good repairman, or maybe do a complete tear-off and put a new roof on, because that's my long-term investment. If instead I'm there for a year, I know I'm selling that house in a year, and my roof begins to leak, I take a, you know, I go to Home Depot and get a patch of tar and I slap something on there. It's that kind of quality of investment that we think that the commission does not have authorities over.
Okay, that was a great answer. My question, Mr. Chair, one more. Gentlemen, let me ask you a little bit about preference power. The public utilities, my understanding, have the right to buy preference power from the Bonneville Power Administration. And they have so much of it they can buy, and then they have to go out on the market and buy other power. Is that or make their own. Is that correct? I mean, do they get it at a cheaper rate because they're a public, right?
Yes.
Okay. For instance, EWEB, Eugene Water and Electric Board, I think generates about a third of its own power, and then they buy some at the preference power rate from BPA, and then they have to go out on the market. And that's why our rates went up, because everybody had this problem that Enron created. Anyway, my question is, if we add another public utility to the mix, if PGE becomes a public utility, how does that affect other public utilities in the state and their ability to buy the same amount of preference power? Is that going to impact the other publics?
Chairman Metzger, Senator Walker, it could or it could not, depending upon how the public chooses to move forward, the new public.
Okay.
I think it's fair to say that Bonneville is fully subscribed, so that if a large new load were demanded of Bonneville, it would diffuse the benefits, I think, a little bit to the current beneficiaries of the system. There are benefits of public ownership. There are rate benefits of public ownership above and beyond the Bonneville situation.
Okay.
There are the tax and financing benefits. Even if you don't factor preference power into it, there are benefits of public power that have a downward pressure on rates. And so the answer is there is no answer, yes or no. It depends upon how the public and, you know, if the legislature chose to get involved with the power authority, for example. I think there's still a lot of options.
Senator Metzger, Senator Walker, I do think, though, one of the things we've encouraged City of Portland, other people that are looking at public ownership, is not to assume that you get it, that a lot of the folks who are right now getting preference power may well fight an attempt that Bonneville has said in different circumstances a new customer would get it essentially at market rates. They would serve somebody but at market rates, but not dilute that preference power. I think the regions would have to grapple with that, but nobody should, I think, go into any sort of discussion over public ownership of PGE with the assumption that a benefit's going to come from public power. I think if it pencils out, if it's a good idea, if it pencils out without, it has to pencil out without that.
Okay.
For it to make sense to customers, because I don't think you can count on that. Bonneville is oversubscribed. There's not extra power there to serve customers. It seems like year after year we're not seeing more snowpack and more hydro being produced, so I think there's a point that the region needs to live within its limits and deal with that. So nobody should assume that that's going to create a huge windfall for PGE customers at all.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Was very, very helpful panel.
on track here so that we get everyone on. I'm going to ask Julie Brandis and Ken Cannon to come forward. And just for your information, Commissioner Sten will be following and give us an idea of our time frame here. I think this has been helpful.
Welcome. Thank you very much, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Ken Cannon, Executive Director of Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. And it's handing out just our membership list. ICNU is an industrial trade association regionally based in Portland. Our role is to represent our members' interest in all matters kind of electrical. So we get heavily involved at the Oregon Public Utility Commission with Bonneville, same function in Washington. We have participated in 5 different utility acquisitions in Oregon and 1 in Washington over the last, since 1996. And in the TPG case, we were a full active participant. We participated extensively in the discovery process, and I would echo what Cub was saying about our concerns on the somewhat overreaching application of the confidential designation during this process. It is something we're going to raise with the PUC after they have made their decision on this. We have spent tens of thousands of dollars arguing with TPG and PGE, trying to get information to be released just to us, even if it's confidential. You look at the internal review committee documents, the financial models, key pieces of information that everyone utilized in the case. And we fought through time and time again. It's very time-consuming, it's very expensive, and as I said, I think it was overdone as far as how much was labeled confidential. At the same time, I would say that we were very dismayed, very frustrated with the release of confidential information. We think the integrity of this process is so important that that is a severe breach. We fight, we play by the rules, we win or lose, but we abide by that protective order. And so for someone to release it, and then for TPG to say later that, well, we'd plan to release this anyhow, then why were we fighting over it for so long? And we did fight over it for a considerable amount of time. We retained expert witnesses. We put on testimony. We went through the cross-examination, the briefing stage. And throughout that, my members were trying to evaluate this deal. And at the end, they, along with everyone else, recommended that the OPUC deny the application. And they still believe that, regardless of all the activities the last 6 weeks, they still are very strongly believing that denial is the right course of action. But they said, obviously, you have to have a fallback position, that if you, if the PUC decides to approve it, that the key is to approve it with very tough, stout conditions. And we have 38 conditions that we submitted as part of our testimony, and conditions that go far beyond those that were identified by the OPUC staff. I think that for the purposes of this meeting here today, and the question that you ask as far as what is your oversight role of PUC, essentially, as they look at these, it is interesting, in the staff brief, this is the OPUC staff brief, they say, while existing regulatory tools are insufficient for the specific potential harms of this transaction, this package, essentially the staff package of conditions, essentially correct that concerns. And I think that is the appropriate way to look at these types of transactions. We know that essentially the regulations that are in place perhaps don't cover all the bases. And that's why we all work very hard to come up with conditions to try and stop different areas where you think that a utility or utility owner can take advantage. And that's where we've come up with the 38 conditions. And some of those that we have added beyond the staff deal with bankruptcy, deal with the enforceability of the conditions, deal with the end game to make sure that whatever type of body that this might be sold to at some time, make sure that that does go through the 511 process. So I think as far as does the commission have the tools, yes, they do. We are strong supporters of the net benefit standards. We participated extensively in UM 1011 supporting the net benefit standard. We believe that it is a standard that needs flexibility because, as we have seen since Enron and then moving forward, it's very hard to forecast the future in this ever-evolving electric utility industry. And so we think the flexibility and discretion lodged at the OPUC is a good place to have that. I think there are a couple things that you could add to 511, and actually one that you could subtract from 511. Someday I'd like to get rid of the kind of the silly 19-day rule as far as that the PUC has to make a decision in 19 days. That was kind of premised on a, you know, the 1980s version of T. Boone Pickens coming in and buying Northwest Natural, and the PUC says no. Well, we've just evolved beyond that, so obviously that's an easy one. I think the adding to the list of the things to consider as far as what's your plan of operation, that's already there. What's your utility experience? That's already there. I think the structure of the type of organization that is buying it, it is important. We also think that the length of time that it is planned to be owned is also important. We understand that people may not know how long they plan to own, but if someone comes in and they're doing all their model runs at 5 years and they say someplace between 5 and 7 years, kind of our average, okay, I think that's helpful to know, and that's helpful for something to be considered during this process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Julie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. To cut to the chase, one of the questions I've been asked the most is, you know, AOI represents the business community, so why is AOI so concerned with a private investor buying this company? Primarily because PGE is a fully regulated monopoly utility providing essential public service. 44% of the state's population depends on PGE for critical service, as well as over 92,000 commercial customers, accounting for about 12% of the customers and 39% of the utility's revenues. Additionally, it's important to note, and this was noted in our brief as well, PGE appears at this point to be operating well. PGE is not in bankruptcy and is able to operate with somewhat independently from Enron. Enron has taken a hands-off approach to the day-to-day management of PGE. Mm-hmm. So what happens to PGE and the rates, the reliability, and the corporate health critically affects the economy and the well-being of the customers we represent, as well as the economy of the state as a whole. And that is why AOI became involved with this case. What we have learned is that the TPG acquisition is very different from any case the PUC has ever seen. It is not a utility purchasing a utility. It is an investment company purchasing a utility. The utility has become the commodity to be bought, prettied up, and sold. The applicant said it best in their own brief. The proposed acquisition is unlike this commission, any that this commission has addressed in the past. This is very different and a very complex acquisition, and the complexities arise from the complex layers of ownership. The PUC would oversee Oregon Electric Company but not have regulatory authority over TPG. The cost and the risk of the double leverage debt structure, the nature of the short-term ownership, and that we believe that local representation does not equal local control. I think Senator Walker made a very good point. Shareholders are not the same thing as captive customers. The consent rights do limit the board's authority. Those consent rights allow veto power over employment and compensation of officers, the adoption of PGE's annual operating budget, capital budget, and financial plans, filings in connection with the PGE rate case. TPG could cause an initial public offering or other sale of PGE without the approval of OEUC or PGE boards. So what you asked specifically, Mr. Chair, for us to discuss things that the legislature may need to address, and one of the discussion points of last week was the net benefit. What we briefed in UM 1121 of the TPG case, we believe the commission should exercise the broad discretion the legislature has given it. And notwithstanding, if something happens in that broad discretion and the commission does not believe it has the statutory or procedural framework adequate to meet the needs to address this case, then we stand ready at AOI to assist the commission and the legislature to advance any search application. That being said, I think it's important to note that prior to this case, if net benefit or public interest had been well detailed in statute, it would be hard to know if the statute would afford the protections needed in the case. And that's why the flexibility of the conditions that we signed on to and those that ICNU signed on to are very important. As stated, this case is very, very different. And making more specific lists in statute doesn't necessarily give more tools. It may limit the commission in exercising its broad authority and discretion. Current law does mandate the following when the commission reviews an acquisition, and these are those that we found most important in looking at this case: an examination of the applicant's identity, the source and the amounts of funds used in the acquisition, an examination of the applicant's experience in operating public utilities, and applicant's plan for operating the utilities. And until we read the UM 1121 order, we won't know how net benefit is applied. We won't know whether the commission feels they don't have enough authority to do their job. This case will decide net benefit and public interest, decide if net benefit and public interest really mean something. Just to add what the other parties have already said, and we would like to emphasize that, the release of the confidential information is a blow to the process. And just as a personally, if you looked at our brief or our reply brief, we did not comment on anything in that process on the confidential information. And the reason why is we are a member-driven organization, and I couldn't say anything of confidentiality and hope to bring my members along to say these are the details of the case. And it made it hard for an association lobbyist. So again, our members may be interested to know what standards the ALJ and the DOJ, the Administrative Law Judge and the Department of Justice, apply to these cases, and if there is a better way to balance the needs between the parties. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Well, I will assume that we have on record three interveners who claim not guilty to releasing the document. Any questions before we move on?
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Yeah.
Ms. Brandis hit on a couple of points that I raised. One, that she's correct that PGE operates well on its own. When the Enron executives were here last week and I asked them about how much PGE was spending on advertising and all that, it just drew a complete blank stare because they have this hands-off approach. And secondly, she's right. When I asked Ms. Fowler earlier if she could cite an example of a financial speculator buying a utility and producing positive results, she could not. And Ms. Brandis pointed that out also. This is an investment company purchasing a utility. This is not our public benefit. A utility purchasing a utility.
Thank you, Senator.
I just want to make
that
comment.
Thank you very much. Mr. Stan, Commissioner Stan. Commissioner Stan is our last invited testimony, and we have three people who say they're more than 100 miles away that I want to get on. So.
Great.
Welcome. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been an interesting afternoon, and I appreciate the invitation to come down. Primarily would be able to answer questions that you might have. I would share with you, I have been working for several years with my colleagues on the City Council, both the past mayor and the current mayor, to put together an alternative. Originally, we looked at this because I think back in the spring of 2002, there was a sense that there were no buyers on the horizon at all, and certainly no local buyers, and still no local buyers, and no other alternatives. As we looked at it, and I'll just give you, if you can't say something very simply, it doesn't make sense. We came up with an alternative model. Essentially, the City of Portland, and it's the City of Portland because we're the ones working on it, we remain open and I think would be delighted to work on something like a state strategy that Senator Deckard mentioned. The end game we're trying to get to is stability, lower rates, local control, and protecting the PGE employees to continue to do their job. And how you get there really makes no difference to us. We've been clear from day one that there is an expectation that no customers would be treated any differently, and certainly the City of Portland or other local governments would not make any money off of this, not a nickel. So the idea is that I think in this environment, and this is a conclusion I came to from studying it, not from some point of view that I started with, I think you're going to see local utilities continue to trade on the international market, certainly the national speculatively, and it makes perfect sense in this day and age for states and communities to own their local infrastructure. PUCA was put in place 70, 80 years ago because of a bankruptcy similar to this. And frankly, Texas Pacific is not allowed to buy the company under federal law, which is why they set up Oregon Electric. And they're not allowed to buy it because it generally is not in a local community's interest to have their local monopoly infrastructure owned by large speculative interests. So here's the model that we came up with, and it's relatively straightforward. The city of Portland, and you could insert the state if you liked, and if you put the right vehicle together, would issue revenue bonds to purchase the entire company. The revenue bonds would have recourse only to the ratepayers and not to the taxpayers, and that's very important to understand. You would then finance the company. We proposed, and I've been working a couple years ago, we set up a regional roundtable, and since then have worked with many elected officials throughout the region. About 20 came together yesterday to put forward their support, about six mayors, some county commissioners, the metro chair. And the idea would be we would set up a board of directors, somewhat ironically, or perhaps because it just makes common sense, much like Texas Pacific did, come up with a qualified board. Our proposal would be that a regional advisory committee that included probably people like yourselves, business people, elected officials, CUB, those kind of folks, would nominate this board, and they would then run the utility. Our simple point of view would be that the best approach would be to hire the PGE employees back to do it as private employees with a management team to be determined through a competitive process. That management team could very well be the one that exists now. 2 years ago when we were negotiating with Enron, the city of Portland put out what's called an RFQ, a request for qualifications, to see who might be interested. We had 23 responses that ranged from public utilities in Canada who do this for a business to the big ones like Duke and others to local companies including Northwest Natural Gas. From a safety standpoint, this would give you permanent stability. It would keep the employees in place. And the cost advantage of a public purchase at this time would be about 10% or $100 million a year back into the Oregon economy. And that's not my opinion. That's just simple economics. And the reason it is very simple. The interest rate that we would get with the revenue bonds is dramatically cheaper than the rate that any investor could get, particularly when we don't have equity in the deal, which needs a much higher return. And we would not collect or pay federal taxes. They don't pay them now, but they collect them. And when you put those things together, you have about $100 million saving cost advantage. And people will play games with, is it a rate savings? Is it a rate reduction? It would be 10% cheaper the day after you started this way from the day before. And it's a 10% cost advantage that's built into the system. From my point of view, and believe me, as an elected official, you know well, you don't get out there lightly on these kind of things because people will go after every detail. I think that then the real issue becomes, can we manage it and run it well, which is why we would propose putting a structure in place that had checks and balances, not a City of Portland department by any stretch of the imagination. The city really, in our model, is a vehicle to do this. And the reason we got into this is, at the moment, we're the only government that has three things, a AAA credit rating, the ability to buy electrical assets by charter outside of our city limits. The counties don't have that, and I've worked closely with all of the county chairs to talk about these issues, and a body that has political will to do it. So if those three things were to come in place somewhere else, then I would think those would be perfectly good ways to do it. And frankly, what we would see is that if you waved your magic wand down 5-6 years from now, as you ask some of the other representatives of the other point of view, rather than having Texas Pacific deciding who they're going to sell it to at that point, we would guess that 5, 6, 10 years from now, we would have spun the utility off and just created a public utility. You wouldn't want to set a hard date for that for two reasons. The companies get its own credit rating, and then you wouldn't want to do it until interest rates are right. Interest rates are relatively good right now, and if they're bad in 5 years, you wouldn't want to spin it off and replace the bonds with worse interest rates, but at some point you would do that. Our 10% model, the savings assumes that we do not get any special treatment from Bonneville Power. We assume that we keep the residential exchange benefits that come now but get nothing in extra. And we assume in that model that all state and local taxes, fees, franchise fees, everything that goes right now to an Oregon jurisdiction of any kind continues to get paid on a voluntary basis. And so it's a relatively straightforward proposal. I submit to you that, and I have friends with and a supporter of many of yours, that when you're sitting in this chair 5 years from now, if we don't step in as a state now, we will be asked to do so in 5 years. And it would cost $1 billion more to do it. There's $1 billion at play right now, and we have an economy that's on the ropes, and we can hardly afford to sit back and say, let's just give this money to a speculative approach. And let me end by saying, having said that, I don't see anything unethical about what Texas Pacific is trying to do. I just don't see anything about it that's in the state's interest. And I would say that from my point of view, I think the PUC, I'm not an expert like most of your other witnesses today are, I think the PUC does have the tools it needs, but I'll know a lot more when they issue their decision. I also do believe that as a city legislator, that the issue of taxes should be addressed with legislation, and I'll very much, as one constituent of yours, be glad to take the risk that someday they will collect an extra buck from me in taxes that they shouldn't have based on the scenario I heard earlier in return for making sure that they always get paid. I'll take that risk, and I think that we should stipulate that if you're going to collect a dollar of taxes, and we are going to be moving to do this locally, we have the same situations, $6 or $7 million in local taxes that were not paid to Multnomah County and to the city of Portland. As far as we can tell, same thing that Senator Deckard said earlier, we believe it was done legally, although we're still doing some work on that to make sure. If it's not, we'll go after those taxes. But we believe it was done legally. We just think our structure never anticipated the situation. And I guess that's where I might end and then open up for any questions you might have, is saying the structure that Texas Pacific has put up is better than the regulations were set up to block. And so if this thing goes through, you don't have control of the situation, and they will do exactly, whether it's, the answer on the due diligence show is here, is those aren't specifically what we plan to do. Well, I think what's going to happen here, again, it's not anything wrong on their part, it just doesn't meet the test. And our state used to be competitive on a few things like low electric rates, and we don't have the breathing room in this competitive world to give away $100 million a year in annual benefit that costs us nothing. It costs us absolutely nothing, and we keep the jobs doing it, and it's simply by setting up a smarter structure. And with all due respect to my good friend Dr. Kohler, it's a lot like OHSU what we're proposing.
Commissioner Stan, thank you very much. I just have a couple of questions here. I appreciate your comment that you reinforced a comment you made earlier a long time ago, at least when we had a conversation, that at least from your perspective, the intent would be to pay in lieu of state taxes. The couple other questions I had, number one was on the revenue bonds that you would propose issuing, do you have authority for that significant of a debt load? I mean, under the different ceilings that might apply, is that in your jurisdiction, can you issue that much debt?
Mr. Chair, yes is the answer, and I'll just amplify with one point. When we were negotiating with Enron, and we were in voluntary negotiations with Enron, we issued a request for actual proposals to the banking community and received 18 responses. Every major investment bank competed to get this business, and it was just potential business. And our proposal at that point was essentially to get this business, you need to do pro bono work for us on the due diligence, and a significant amount that you won't get. Contingency is probably a better word than pro bono. And we had 18 compete. I would say every bank competed except for a couple that had conflicts of interest with other potential buyers. We selected Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs did lots and lots of due diligence and issued a commitment to us to issue the bonds, and really saw no issues whatsoever with it. And frankly, we told them, assume a purchase price that gives us plenty of room to see the rate reduction based on the parameters I've put in place and said in this conversation today. And so from my point of view, the idea that somebody would finance this with 2.3, let's call it, that's not exactly right, $1 billion, it should give you a lot more certainty that the cost advantage I'm sharing is right, because Goldman Sachs understood very, very well the pledge that we were making publicly, and they would not have agreed to underwrite this if they felt that we were going to put the bonds at risk with those types of rate advantages.
Okay. My final question on that, about your own due diligence. I don't know the exact figure, but I heard it was in the millions of dollars that TPG did for due diligence. And I just wonder how well your due diligence has been on a prospective purchase of PGE from a public standpoint, and the liabilities that you would not be able to go through a PUC to help limit for your ratepayers.
Well, a simple answer to the liabilities, Mr. Chair, is that I believe that if you look closely at either of these structures, the ultimate liability is going to be with the ratepayers. And I believe you can dress that up different ways, but I think that's where it lands. And I'm not going to go into great detail, and there's very scholarly lawyers here who will argue that I'm completely wrong on that, but it's common sense to me. We spent about $1 million of money, and that was taxpayer money and people take pot shots at the city of Portland, but this is the region's interest, and we put up $1 million, and our only request, if this goes through, is we get paid back that. We don't don't want any fee on it. And did very ample due diligence. Unfortunately, Enron would not let anybody see the financials without signing a confidentiality agreement. And so our consultants, but we used R.W. Beck, Goldman Sachs, and Public Financial Management Group, and some individuals as well, to both value and look at all the assets. We did not go to the full, and I want to be absolutely candid about this, level that Texas Pacific did. What we would hypothetically have done is gone to that level once we had some sense that a deal was possible. We don't believe that the deal fell through because we were an unviable buyer. We believe for a lot of reasons that Texas Pacific was more inclined, or Enron was more inclined to sell it to Texas Pacific from the get-go, and you can speculate for yourself if I'm right about that. But
okay. Thank you. Questions for Commissioner Stanton, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on the question that the Chair just asked about the money that the City of Portland has spent investigating this. You said it's about $1 million. Would the city? Would you elaborate or provide any additional detail, maybe not now, but later, about how exactly the city spent those resources?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I'm sure be glad to. I mean, it's all public records how we spend our money, and we could shared that before. But it's essentially a combination of three things. One was financial due diligence on the company. The other was operational due diligence and thinking. And then most of the money went to lawyers to negotiate, and that wasn't going into financial or operations. And then we spent some money on public outreach and staffing the process to talk to leaders throughout the region. So those would be all the areas it went to.
Yes. A couple of follow-ups. The model that you envision for the governance, the board of directors, would that be proportional based on the number of ratepayers where they were in the region that PG&E serves, or how would you envision that being set up, and who, you know, how would the six, you know, suggest that process be implemented?
Mr. Chair and Senator, let me just say, we've put forward an idea with the notion that we're totally open to working with it to improve it from a regional perspective. So for your constituents on the west side of the region, I have been meeting constantly with Tom Bryan and with Mayor Drake and others. Mayor Hughes was on our roundtable. And the idea is, you know, let's figure out the best way to do it so it works. And so what I'm going to say now is here's our best shot, and we're open and willing to look at any way of improving it. And again, what I said is we would gladly step aside and support another proactive solution that meets these parameters. We have proposed that we appoint an advisory council, and that council have all the representative senses that you do with these kind of things. So we could industrial representatives, citizen representatives, elected representatives. We could have legislative representatives, but have an advisory council from throughout the region that would look, you know, generally like these types of things do when you're trying to get good solid advice. And then we would designate the nomination of board members to the Public Utilities Board to this advisory council. And what I mean by that is this advisory council made up of folks throughout the region that would have some sort of proportional basis. We want to work on exactly what the right one would be, would choose the nominees for the board. They would then go to the mayor, and the mayor would make the appointments. For the time period in which the underlying financing, whether that's a short time period or permanent, is municipal, the mayor of Portland needs to appoint the board members, but there's no reason we can't do it in a way that has the region select them. The actual appointment would come from the mayor. And so as you can see with all of this, what we've been trying to do in this pretty tricky situation is come up with how do you get the benefits of public ownership, the benefits of private expertise and the PG management employee skills, and set up a regional utility, but be able to at the same time negotiate with some pretty cutthroat situation with the creditors of Enron. And so what you'd see again is the city coming out of this with the assets, but then setting up this regional utility. And each of the pieces then have to be molded to fit that reality and hopefully then transition. You know, frankly, I think, you know, if the state was moving on a model, you might get into a situation where it made sense to have the City of Portland make the purchase and then transition them to the new model, depending on how the timing of everything works. So,
and can I ask one final question? With all due respect, Commissioner, a lot of my constituents kind of look at the City of Portland, and the first question that comes to their mind, and they relate to me, is this the City of Portland that wants to buy PGE, the same City of Portland that has the highest water and sewer rates probably of any city in Oregon, possibly any city in the United States. The same city that wants to buy a public utility that serves customers that are far, far wider than the boundaries of the city itself.
Yeah.
Care to help me talk to my constituents about their, you know, looking out of their corner of their eye at the city of Portland thinking, there's something wrong with this picture?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, that's why I'm here today. I mean, the choice is yours. You're the leadership. You've called this meeting. Your constituents, Intel is 5% of the load, $54 million in electrical rates, $36 million before Enron took over. That bill goes down $5.4 million the day you put a public purchase in place. My conversations with Intel lead me to believe that they think that's a significant amount of money. We don't believe the city of Portland should run it for lots of reasons, some of them because the political, I'd say not really because it's easy to take a political pot shot, but because it doesn't make sense. It does not make sense for the city of Portland to run a utility that serves the whole region. So we've stepped out and said, here's a model, and here's a model by which we can gain the local control, get the rates down dramatically, and set up a regional utility. If the city of Portland being the vehicle allows people to prefer to pay the high rates and not take advantage of that, that's their choice. And I think in terms of, it's really your call. Do you want to get in this, kind of get smart on the model that the different sides are pitching or not? And that's really your call. I wouldn't push either way.
Thank you. What I'm going to do, I'm going to have to do this. I'm sure you'll be very disappointed in that, Commissioner Sten, but I'm going to ask Commissioner Sten to be excused because we only have 15 minutes left, and I want a few people to be up here before we adjourn. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
But you'd be welcome to come back, and we may very well have that happen depending on how things materialize.
Anytime you'd like. Thank you.
Here's what I'm going to ask. I've got five people who have signed up, and I'm going to ask, first of all, if they're on the same side, because I would definitely have somebody else come up. If Mr. Parrish and Liz Trojan and Scott Forrester, who all claim they're 100 miles away, I'm going to ask them where they live, are you all on the same side on this issue?
Oh,
I didn't say you're working together, but if I'm going to hear the same thing, I'm going to ask someone else. Are all three of you opposed to the current deal? Okay. Okay, I understand. Is anybody, Mr. Ernest Delmazzo and Ann Fisher, are you both here? Are you both opposed to the deal also? Is anybody in support of this deal? Because I'm going to give you a chance, otherwise. Okay. And Ann?
I represent the Managers Association.
Okay. Okay, then.
I have a suggestion for
Okay. Mr. Parrish, Ms. Trojan, Scott Forrester, you've got 13 minutes left. I know you all have written testimony that will all be entered in the record. So in fairness to all the others, and we'll have other opportunities for this, but I'm going to give you some chance today because you've been sitting and you've had a chance to hear things. So I'll ask you not to read any of the testimony so you don't deprive your others of having a chance to get on the record. And then we'll read your testimony, and as we pursue this further, we'll have longer discussions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Fisher stopped me in the hallway, and she does have a statutory proposal that I would
Great.
Just ask her to submit to the committee,
Great.
And we can ask her at a later time if we
that
don't
would
have
be wonderful,
time to talk.
Because that's what we're trying to get to. So welcome. Let's proceed, and I would ask, under the circumstances, that you speak from the heart rather than read, and we'll get each of you to have a comment.
So do I have 3 minutes, Chair? Is that
yes.
reasonable?
Yes,
okay.
Go yeah. please do.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Bill Parrish. I'm a resident of Portland. I'm opposed to the TPG purchase. Let's ask one basic question.
100 miles away, so you left already. So you only now you got 2 minutes. Okay.
This track it passed already. Yeah. Thank you. Let's ask ourselves, first of all, where's David Bonderman? And what is he doing differently from what Charles Keating did? The Oregon Investment Council is their largest investor. PG would be their largest investment. Where is he? What's private equity, really? In the old days, it was wealthy individuals. Today, they're pilfering public pensions. Who's really backing TPG's efforts to take over PG? It's Credit Suisse, the same company that issued most of the egregious partnerships of Enron's. Peggy Farrell's opening remark, this would be investor-owned utility, is not correct because it wouldn't be SEC-regulated. It's totally different, a private equity situation. Where's Tom Potter, former police chief? He held a press conference. He's stepped up based on Eric Stent's heavy lifting over a long period of time. I hope you'll support him. Basically, the public's dialed 911. You've got a former police chief and a firefighter up in Portland and everyone else saying, let's get behind this thing. Sometimes a prop's helpful, and so I brought one today. I don't want to be offensive to anyone, but I'm going to pull it out because Charles Keating taught us a valuable lesson. It was a great industry, the savings and loans, and he took it down. The public pensions are a great industry, and right now today, Arnold Schwarzenegger is trying to abolish it in California and convert it to a 401k. And private equity abuses are a key part of this. Charles Keating served 5 years, hard time in a real prison. And the way he got by was he endeared himself to his fellow inmates by cleaning all the toilets in his cell wing of roughly 70 inmates. It's an astonishing lesson Charles Keating provides us. He was a devout Catholic. He considered himself to be honest. But at the end of the day, no one was there. Ask yourself, what would have happened if someone like myself would have been there with an analogy like this? Maybe it would have frightened him. We've got some great local people here. Peter Kohler, doing a great job at OHSU. Tom Walsh, who I deeply respect. It's a disaster. The tax issue, Peter Kohler, you shouldn't be even mentioning the tax issue. They'll never pay any taxes. I'm a CPA. It's not about consolidation. It's about a spectacular loophole Steve Dean wrote about in the June or July Oregonian feature. Bob Packwood, former chair of the Senate Finance Committee, was quoted in saying, again, they will never pay taxes. This isn't complicated. Arizona, why did they reject KKR? That's where Charles Keating was based. John McCain was one of the Keating Five. John McCain. Now he's a champion of reform. He's instituting all kinds of reforms in Congress. And my final comment, I guess, is DPG's related companies, there's no discussion of that. PG's just going to become a feed bucket for them to sell natural gas to and all kinds of equipment with no oversight or disclosure. I've got all this chronicled on my website at www.billparish.com, a list of references, analysis, and commentary. My final comment, I guess, is that this is a monumental financial fraud. Nothing but that. This won't be an investor-owned utility. It'll be a feed bucket in which speculators create an executive comp bonanza for themselves and fleece our region's most important economic asset. And again, ask yourself one final question. Where's David Bonham and Calvin Davis? I'll leave this, I guess, since they're not here, with Peter Kohler and Tom Imelson with a very confidential reflection inside.
Thank you, Bill. I assume you're opposed, so that's good. Liz, if you would tell us where you're from.
Hi, I'm from Portland.
Oh, geez, and it's getting farther away all the time. I live up in Mount Hood, and I'm only 80 miles away, and somehow I went right through Portland, didn't know, and I had gone in a circle. Go ahead.
Chair Metzger, Senators, my name is Liz Trojan. I'm a 14-year customer of PGE and a member of the Oregon Public Power Coalition. We're pleased that the Senate Committee on Business and Economic Development is holding hearings on the sale of PGE and Texas Pacific Group. In the Portland area, we've been dealing with this issue of PGE's future since Enron declared bankruptcy. Since 1997, over $1 billion has been siphoned off in the form of manipulated rates and phony taxes. $92 million a year collected in quote-unquote taxes. $2 million each week, and this continues to this day. This is money that we could be spending here locally on schools, state police, and other government functions. The Oregon Public Power Coalition was actively involved in getting PUDs on the ballot in Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, and Yamhill counties. The PUD elections did not succeed due in no small part to the huge sums of money spent by PGE opposing them. In the Multnomah County election alone, PGE spent $3.5 million to defeat the PUD effort. We were outspent 100-1. Despite PGE's lavish spending, a third of the Multnomah County voters, that's 48,000 people, voted yes on the PUD. The two primary benefits of public ownership of our local utility are local control and lower rates. PGE has been for sale 4 times in the last 5 years. We want off this buy and sell carousel. Lower rates are critical to improving Oregon's economy, and I have a lovely rate chart here showing PGE's rates compared to 28 publicly owned utilities. These figures come from the PUC. All 28 publicly owned utilities have lower rates. So we know that PGE will be sold. What better time to move forward with public ownership? And the analogy we would like to use is home ownership. Why rent when you can buy?
Okay. Thank you, Liz.
I'm not actually finished
here. I know,
here.
But I want Mr. Forrester. I want two other people, otherwise, because you have it written down, and I'd like to have that. So.
Okay, it's sort of chicken scratch, so I'd have to rewrite it. But.
Okay.
Rewrite.
I'm almost done. We, as our elected representatives, we're pleased that you're looking into further definition of net benefit, dealing with the taxation issue, Senate Bill 408, and issues about confidentiality of documents. We would appreciate your support in our endeavors to create public ownership of our local utility, and we support the City of Portland's efforts to municipalize our local utility. Thank you
Thank
for
you
the chance to speak.
Georgian. Mr. Forrester, I have two people after you.
I understand. I'll try to be quick.
And where are you from, Mr. Forrester? Are we going to be three to three here?
I live in Gresham, but it feels like 100 miles away.
That's what I thought. Okay.
my senator might be able to attest to that fact. I'm one of the 47 interveners, one of the silent partners, not the big players, representing the Friends of the Clackamas River. And we're an environmental group, been around for over 10 years, representing things that can't speak for themselves, such as endangered species of salmonids, of which the coho salmon, one of the best runs left in the lower Columbia River, flows. They swim through Portland's Superfund Harbor on their way to their ancient spawning grounds in the Clackamas. Well, PGE owns three hydroelectric dams there, cheap power, but the cheap power is built on the basis of killing salmon and their habitat. We believe and have voted unanimously as our board that we not only oppose Texas Pacific Group, but we favor the City of Portland's takeover and using help with of the regional partners to create a publicly owned utility out of Portland General Electric / Enron. The Oregon Electric Utility Company board members are well-qualified and honorable people, but they'll still allow the export from Oregon's residential and business electricity users between $800 million and $1.2 billion in the next 5 to 10 years. So you'll feel good about it, feel good about that export, but you'll still have a smile on your face, I guess. You can see Willamette Week's Secret Docs article for that. In 1997, Enron purchased PGE for over $3 billion. Now it's on sale for $2.35 billion. What happened to the extra billion? Well, that extra billion is going to be gotten back by the Texans upon resale on the market. Quiz question, how many times in the 100-year proud PGE history have they been bankrupt? The answer is 3 times. So we keep reliving history. So while we let the free market work, we forget about its inadequacies.
Okay, Mr. Forrester, I'm not trying to be impolite to you, but I'm trying to be polite to the other two people who want to get
I
out.
Have one suggested potential bill here.
There you go. Now you're getting there.
Okay. The OPUC is mandated by law to balance the entrance between consumers and utilities. So there's a balance test, 50-50. I think the consumers are getting less than 50%. There appeared to be a conflict of interest when Chairman Lee Beyer apparently spoke before the Oregon Business Association against people's utility districts. I thought he would be neutral. You might want to look into that. Also, the committee might best be working towards a draft bill that would allow the three Oregon Public Utility Commission members to be elected statewide, as was the law and practice in the early part of the 1900s. This would reestablish direct accountability of the regulated utility oversight. The election process, the candidates' public statements and campaign promises would be the basis of their mandate on behalf of the voters and ratepayers. And just as you are held accountable by the electorate, so would a directly elected public utility commission. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, our last two testimonials in the last 5 minutes here, Ernest Delmazzo and Ann Fisher. And I'm going to ask Ann to go first because she says she actually has a suggestion, which is what we're trying to get to here.
And because I didn't think I was actually going to speak.
And again, if you have written testimony, we'll put that in the record, and we will read that and use that as we move forward. So.
What I've provided are...
Please identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Well, what I've provided are just copies of my proposal. My name is Ann Fisher, and I have worked for Building Owners and Managers Association in the proceedings with Texas Pacific Group as well as the energy dereg proceedings. My observation is what I came to share with you today about the ability of the commission to do what we all think it should do, which is to make a good decision about the future of customers and ratepayers in Oregon. I have a proposal here that's all tweaks, if you will, of the statute 757.511. I think that it was written in 1985. It's become a mallet, not a hammer, and I want to make it more of a hammer. The changes are as follows. The first one, and you can see from your document the language, but I'll just explain them. The first one places somebody like TPG squarely under the PUC jurisdiction in considering the application. The exemptions, which are both one and two, are both are covered here, allow someone who controls but only owns 5% of the voting stock, and that's the reason TPG is designed as it is. It has all the control, but it still meets the exemption for not being covered by PUC authority because it owns less than 5. The next one would allow the commission to expressly consider the disparity between the benefits to the customers and the amount of profit that the buyer would take out in the end. I don't know what the right answer is. I think the commission has been charged with figuring out those kind of things. I want to make it express that they be given the authority to expressly look at the end result for the buyer and the end result for the customers. Taxes have been a big thing. One way to treat it does not impact any of the things that, for instance, Senator Walker is doing, but it would allow the commission to require, if it chose to, that all taxes collected would be paid directly by the utility to the respective governmental entity and let the buyer, owner, argue with them about whether or not they get some back, a write-off, whatever. But the taxes would go where they're supposed to go. Finally, this is complicated stuff. As you know, everyone's eyes tend to glaze over. It's hard. The commission is outstanding. The staff is outstanding, has a very good reputation, but they still don't have necessarily the expertise to fully consider all of these issues. And so I would provide that they would be allowed to hire temporary expertise with the cost not to be paid by the PUC or the ratepayers or the customers, but the applicants themselves. And so I think that would improve the process. It would certainly give things that are issues here to the commission to be able to look at, and I don't think they can now.
Thank you.
One quick question.
Very quick, because we got to go.
Are you representing yourself or BOMA?
Both, Senator okay. Starr and
so
Chairman
Metzger. I can put BOMA on this.
You may put BOMA on
Thank
this.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Delmazzo, and I've read your thing already, so you're interested in the juxtaposition between PERS retirees and as one of the issues here and for the ratepayers. So if you'd identify yourself and kind of summarize that issue, that's interesting.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Ernie Delmazzo. I'm here as a professional researcher who studied this issue for about 2 years now. I also represent Injured Workers Alliance, a group that's hard hit by the 41% overall rate increases of November 2001. My major concern studying the proposal for sale is the investment by Oregon PERS along with CalPERS. We know that the sale is for $2.35 billion, including $1.1 billion in debt cost liabilities. What is less known is that it only involves $525 million of investor equity. This is the amount that TPG, along with Oak Tree and the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation and other parties are investing. So essentially, with the $525 million they are investing, they're adding another $707 million in debt. Obviously, this makes this a highly leveraged buyout. We do know that Oregon PERS invested $300 million. They have a total of about $950 million in TPG. The $300 million will be in the equity fund that TPG is using, as far as we know. And that's been part of the problem. We don't know all the details. TPG has been very secretive. Obviously, PERS money could total $300 to $400 million. Reason being is Oak Tree also has about $100 million of Oregon PERS money. So essentially, you're going to have a situation where $300 to $400 million of the $525 million is Oregon PERS money. And obviously, that would put great stress upon the PUC, because what we've created what Texas Pacific is creating with this is pitting ratepayers against retirees. And obviously, this concerns the legislature because, quite ironically, you could be in a situation where economic upheaval occurs. You could be asked to have the state of Oregon and all its taxpayers bail out this deal. TPG actually has a history. They actually took a California company into bankruptcy. At the same time, there's case precedent in this area. Pacific Gas and Electric was a situation where essentially they threatened, filed for bankruptcy, and as a result, the higher courts, federal court, ruled that they could sell their generation assets. And even though this has changed recent news to some degree, essentially what it results in is PGE will retain $3.2 billion in surplus rate revenues it collected. It'll recover an additional $2.21 billion from ratepayers over 9 years, and PG&E will issue $8 billion in debt securities, costs and repayments of which will be recovered in rates. This is a huge undertaking. We also have another situation.
I'm going to have to stop you there because the other committee is now coming in. You have articulated an issue I have thought about, is the issue of a large investor who has a fiduciary responsibility to retirees against the other one. That's a very legitimate issue.
I would be very happy to talk in depth on this issue. I know this quite well.
I know you've stated it, and I appreciate that. Members, before we adjourn here, first of all, he's not here, but I want to thank Senator Shields and the other committee who's given us time to come in here. That's very appreciative. For all of you, we're going to look at, I think there's been a few things that have been identified here through the help of everyone to look at. We'll explore further in terms of the legislative role and as we move through utility legislation. Secondly, on our next meeting will be on Thursday, regular time from 1 to 3. I will be gone. I'll be on legislative business in Cascade Locks and Hood River on Thursday. Senator Starr will chair the committee, and we have our first slate of bills, and I'm sure you'll be all here on time to give him support to move through those hearings. And then on Friday, our committee will be the first one that is going on the road. And at 10 a.m., we did this in the morning so people could have the afternoon free, at 10 a.m. at Hillsborough in the school administration auditorium area. And Teresa will get you all the directions. We will be convening at 10 a.m. We will be doing hearings and work session, and we'll have the seatbelt bill. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what some of the young people have to say about that, as well as some other pieces of legislation. So we'll have a chance to get the public involved in that directly.
Well, Mr. Chair, my Judiciary Committee is on the road Friday as well, so you are
but
not...
But we start before you do.
Oh.
So with that, we're adjourned.